now be with the same team again.
Right.
So can we please have somebody to propose the option of the agenda? Honourable James, seconded by Honourable Vandermeer. You see how quickly I saw you. We are picking up more seriously from where we left off last night, where we went through and we were going to get a nice clean bill, A list as well. Clean. So I don't want to see any colour here. Am I right? I'm not going to see any colour here, DDG. Black, all black. Yeah. No, the point I'm asking is because I see green here. Well, there we are, there's this at the back. I see green. That's what I'm asking, DEG. It's not all black, you see. So perhaps you can just alert me as to where that comes from.
Yes, sir. In the meeting yesterday, there were some proposals to amend something. We would have kept it black. We would like to see it like that. But we thought, out of fairness, we would not allow those minor changes that we agreed to yesterday.
You see, I'm only aware of two. The last one, which we agreed on a semantic basis. And then I see here, though, we've got a second one, which is on page 4. Are those the only two?
Madam Chair, last one is on the very last page of the A list. In fact, the last two lines of the A list. Okay.
But it's a three. Let's see where the third one is. The third one is on page 2. All right. Let's just tackle that very quickly, starting from page 2. We need to tackle the last page. But just 2 and 4. EG?
Chair, I'll advocate Strader to take us through this.
Okay. With your permission, Madam Chair, on page 2 of the A list, that's item spells, page 4 of the lines 24, 26, 29, and 30, we omit those paragraph numbers. And we respectively substitute with what we have in there. There's nothing in it as far as substance is concerned. It is merely a matter of rectifying the number of those paragraphs. Allow me, Madam Chair, to move straight away to the second green portion of the bill. That is on page 4 of our bill. On page 9, from line 57, to omit paragraph V, substitute, that is consequential to the omission of paragraph S that we discussed yesterday evening. Take all reasonable steps to recover any amount in relation to a grant which has been withdrawn, prohibited, or reduced in terms of section 33. We will recall from yesterday's discussion that this power is not a power of the board, but it's a ministerial power, and therefore we had to make a small consequential amendment to this provision. So the board would be in a position to take these steps in order to recover any grants that have been paid after the minister had withdrawn, prohibited, or reduced. There is nothing more to it than that, Madam Chair. Needless to say, you already mentioned that the last one we don't even need to deal with. It's just a matter of rephrasing. Thank you, Madam.
Right. The other one, thank you, Advocate Stridham, is the issue that several of them, two of them in particular here, fresh ones that Honourable Hill Lewis raised with respect to 13A4, of course, and the question had been put about the process, which I thought had been cleared up in the sense that it was the same process. You may wish to reiterate that, but entirely fresh was the issue about what will happen to the revenue generated, and how will a state organ be established? Who is going to tackle that? Advocate Stridham?
Madam Chair, needless to say, as far as the considerations of policy are concerned, your DDG will do the necessary response. But allow me only to refer to the matter of procedure, because that is provided for in the A-list. May we refer to the A-list, Madam Chair? Page 5 of the A-list. It is just below the middle of the page. It's item 3. In appointing an organ of state to conduct the lottery, the minister may exempt such organ of state from the provisions of section 13 sub 2 and sub 3 as we find them in the Principal Act. I've got the Principal Act here, Madam Chair, and I think the members are in possession as well. That is the Principal Act. It is section 13. It's a lengthy provision. I will not read it, but maybe just very briefly refer to the content. The first one that the minister would be exempted from is subsection 2 in section 30 in respect of a license that is granted either in terms of the permanent license to conduct the lottery or this new license that might be granted by the...
Members, we're just here on the Principal Act. Okay, Principal Act, and we're referring to 13, Chapter 2. Is this correct? Just want this clear, because we have got page numbers very clearly on this one.
Madam Chair, the amendment in the A-list is on page 5 of the A-list. The section in the Principal Act is section 13. And the two subsections are subsection 2 and 3. Those are the subsections that the minister would be exempted from in appointing, or when the minister takes the decision based on those justifiable grounds that we had discussed, that he or she does not deem it appropriate to appoint a licensee at all. That is where that vacuum exists. Then it says that the minister would be exempted from what we find in subsection and subsection 3. So all the requirements relating to the granting of the intention, inviting comment and the rest as we find it in sub 2, as well as those requirements in subsection 3, would not apply to the minister when the decision is taken not to appoint a licensee at all, but instead thereof to appoint an organ state for a certain period to do the necessary. Now, I hope I'm not being presumptuous. The DDG, we had a brief discussion just prior to this meeting commencing. And the question has arisen as to whether it would be advisable, with respect, for the minister to be exempted from these requirements as we find them in sub 2 and sub 3. Because if we read them, all of it, save for what we find in B, small Roman 4, I will read it just now, it might well be advisable that they should be applicable, even in this scenario. The only possible exemption might be what we find in small Roman 4. No political party in the Republic or political office bearer has any direct financial interest in the applicant or a shareholder of the applicant. Madam Chair, allow me to leave it there for discussion.
Thank you very much. Yes, all are raised their hands. Just a policy aspect to it. Now, technically speaking, as it were, you are saying that No, well, it's 2, you know, it's chapter 2, 13, 2, A, B, 1, Roman 1, 2, and 3. But when it comes to Roman 4, technically speaking, you're thinking, with the exception of that, in other words, it should apply, you know, in another way of putting it. So that's the technical input. GDG, do you want to say anything in that respect, from a policy perspective?
Madam Chair, if I could, just for the sake of absolute clarity, as it stands at the moment, with the proposed amendment in the AS, a blanket ministerial exemption would apply where the minister takes that particular stance not to appoint a licensee. It seems that from a policy perspective that I will not speak on, that might not necessarily be the correct stance. That if we read these requirements that must be met in order for the ordinary licensee to be appointed, they might well be applicable in the case where the minister deems it appropriate to appoint an organ of state to do the necessary. And that maybe there should be a slight tweak of this amendment to say that the minister would be exempted only in respect of what we have in small Roman 4, which is where a political party has any material financial interest in respect of the licensee. As far as the policy issues are concerned, Madam Chair, I will go silent.
Right. Well, let's just get the queries from and comments from members then. Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable Vandermeer, Honourable Frick.
Chair, I had my hand up fairly early because I'm afraid I think the department's misunderstood my question. If we just look at the question, I was referring specifically to the process outlined in 13A4. That is not the process of the minister issuing a license to a state organ. That is the process of the state organ sub-issuing that license to a third party. And that is the process I was asking about, not the process of the minister issuing a license to a state organ.
You happy? GDG, so just let's suspend the questions for the moment.
Chair, we did not misunderstand the question. I think what Advocate Stradom was raising is in relation to some of the things in the amendments that we might need to consider. But in regard to the question that the Honourable Member has asked in this list of questions in relation to Section 13A4, currently under the legislation, if the licensed operator decides to appoint somebody else to run the license on their behalf, they do need the approval of the minister. So this is just consistent with that. So there isn't a specific process that is outlined, but then it will be with the approval of the minister because the minister would have appointed that particular operator, not somebody else. So to the extent that there may be maybe some contradictions or maybe gaps that are picked up, we are willing to propose any changes or anything to remedy that gap.
In a way, there are two issues on the table. The one's just been brought up, which does not appear to be in direct relation to what you asked. But nevertheless, let's consider it as a whole. Honourable Hill Lewis.
Yeah, just, the reason I raised it, if we just go to page 4 of the A list on clause 12, we actually, if I recall, this was at the request of the departments, included this process for the what I've just called sub-licensing to a third party, that the board should make a recommendation to the minister to allow such appointment if the person to be appointed has satisfied the provisions of Section 13(2)(b) of the Principal Act and any other requirements or conditions as directed by the minister. Now, that proviso is precisely what I'm talking about, because the proviso exists here for the sub-licensing to a third party, but not on the next page. And so I'd like to see it on both pages.
Okay. Honourable Van der Merwe, followed by Honourable Thrum.
Chair, I am asking this because I might not be reading everything together, but if you're going to exempt the minister from applying 13(2) and 13(3) in the case where he wants to appoint an organ of state, what happens to 6? So it's basically 6 on the Principal Act. Before license is granted under the section, then in considering whether to grant the license contemplated in 1, the minister and board shall not favour an applicant solely because the applicant or shareholder partner of that applicant is an organ of state. But he's actually giving it to an organ of state. It may be covered somewhere else, but it would seem to me that he would need to apply different criteria in appointing an organ of state. And maybe all these should be exempt, and in a separate set should be identified. I'm asking.
I'm going to take the Honourable Thring, but then I'm going to allow the department itself to just discuss this among themselves, because I think we also need to discuss it, because it's in a way, it's brought a fresh angle to things, which probably you didn't anticipate yourself, Honourable Hildreth. Honourable Thring?
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I think that there was wisdom in, and correct me, I think, if I'm wrong in this, but we had reduced the period of a organ of state being granted a license to 2 years, 24 months? No? So, okay. All right. But I think that the discussions, Honourable Chair, point in that particular direction, because if one looks at the challenges that we currently have, so there may be wisdom as we get to that stage to consider all of these challenges we're currently having now. When one appoints an organ or gives an organ of state a license. But I would, my statement would have been in concurring with our advocate in that, and the Honourable Van der Merwe, in that possibly we'd actually need to re-look at sections 2 and 3 of Chapter 2 in the Principal Act. Thank you very much.
We're going to have a very short adjournment here, because this is something fresh that's come up. I want us to all be quite clear in our minds. Are we agreed? 5 minutes.
It might have been a slip of tongue, Chair. I apologise. I refer to page 5
of the A list is in item 3. It is item 3 on page 5. In appointing the organ of state to conduct a national lottery, the minister may exempt such organ of state from the provisions of section 13(2) and sub 3 in the Principal Act. I'm not going to read those again. I think we all reflected on them just a while ago. And before I carry on, just for the sake of the picture, allow me very briefly to say the following. We must keep in mind here that we're dealing now only with a scenario where the minister deems it appropriate, because of justifiable grounds being in existence, not to appoint a licensee at all to conduct the lottery. We're not dealing with a scenario where a licensee is in place and would like maybe to appoint another person to assist in conducting certain lotteries. This is only where the minister deems it appropriate not to grant the license at all. Then, Madam Chair, and we apologize for the fact that it is new, but there was no need for shying away from the principle. I think the DDG has already made it clear that this exemption should not apply in a blanket manner in respect of subsection 2 and 3, as we find them in section 30, because if we read them, it seems as if they should be applicable, even if an organ of state is about to be appointed as a licensee. So this would be my humble suggestion, Madam Chair, that this amendment should be rephrased to exclude what we're finding in section 13(2)(a) and in B4. 13(2)(a) is the one that relates to the notice in the Gazette by the minister to invite interested parties to apply. That is in the Principal Act now. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, for being okay here and there. I've got no option.
Hang on.
Section 13(2),
right,
small a in brackets, that requirement, as well as what we find in B, small Roman 4, allow me, that is a short one to read it, Madam Chair. No political party in the Republic or political office bearer has any direct financial interest in the applicant or a shareholder of the applicant. This is our suggestion, that the amendment be rephrased to make it clear that everything that we find in sub 2 and 3 will be applicable, save for these two. It is sometimes a bit problematic to do the actual drafting whilst we're in committee, but it would be in fairly simple terms, Madam Chair, just make it clear that the exemption does not apply in a blanket manner, but only those two provisions are being exempted. If I can leave that one there for the time being, if there might be discussion.
Honourable Chair, you know, I'm concerned about the way we have dealt with, because we have jumped the other clauses before we passed them, and we went straight to 18, whereas there are still things which are still outstanding in the previous clauses. So what I suggest, Chair Person, is that let's deal with this 18 and finish it off, and then we move page by page on the 8. I think that's something.
So that's what we said we'd do. We wanted to deal with these issues that had come up from the amendments, you see, which are 13, and then we're starting. Yeah, so we're in line with exactly what you are proposing, but I want to make sure that we're all clear then. The DEID advocate is proposing now that when it comes to 13(2)(a), this is the issue in question, as well as 13(2)(b)(4). So with respect to the organ of state, you're going to craft something else. And I just want to be quite clear, you're going to craft an amendment. When is this amendment coming? Because this is going to creep today.
Madam Chair, it can be done today. It's not present a problem.
Look at it before it gets decreed. That's what I'm trying to say.
May I make a suggestion, Madam Chair, when you proceed with the other part of the agenda, that we simply do the necessary and possibly return with your permission.
Then we're on track. Right. Honourable Hill-Lewis.
But I don't understand how we can exempt a political party office bearer from having a financial interest in the operating of the license.
Madam Chair, that's why we're saying that it would require a recraft of the amendment. We can't do it along the terms that we're having there. That's why we're asking the opportunity to do a redraft, to make it clear, the distinction that you're referring to, that it's properly reflected in the amendment. We are aware of the sentiment.
Yeah, so we're not dealing with the amendment right now. It's simply noted that this will be amended and come straight back here. Right, today. Fine. Now we've dealt with that, all right? And we're going to now move to page one. Honourable Hill-Lewis?
There was still the other amendment that I proposed.
How will the state organ be established? How will it be funded and who will head it? Is that the one?
No, the one under 13A4.
Very, very briefly refer to that one. This is on page 4 of our A-list, right at the bottom. It is the provider that is applicable here. We have conceded, if the committee would approve, that very same provider to go to page 10 of the bill in line 46 to be inserted just after subsection 4. It simply makes sense that the same proviso should apply in that scenario.
I think we are on track with that 13, okay? So let's move to page 1 of the bill. Right. Okay.
But Chairperson, yes. We haven't dealt question 2 and 3.
Do it, thanks. Page 1. Well, page 2, really. Page 2. Page 3. Page 4. Page 5. Page 6. Honourable Khadib.
Thank you, Chairperson. On page 6, in particular on the restraint of trade, yesterday I moved that the issue of the commissioner must also be dealt with, in particular coming to the issue of grants. That the commissioner and then Honourable Superintendent Member added also the immediate statement of the commissioner that there must be a restraint on trade in particular to any organization that has received grant from the commission 2 years even after that grant has been, there must be no employment to that. It's not here even on the ADC. Yeah, it's not there.
This we agreed on as a committee would apply to only to the commissioner. Was agreed. Now, does the DTI agree or not? Otherwise, we get to put it in anyway.
Madam Chair, allow me to deal with it initially, and I think it would then be appropriate for the DDG to make the necessary response. This we find on page 8 of the bill. Of the bill. Okay, page 8 of the bill. And it's in line 30.
there is a heading, confidentiality and restraint of trade. And page 8 of the film, line 30. And the operative part is subsection 2. And I'm here, I'm offering another apology. A member of the board, or his or her spouse, life partner, allow me to stop there, also in fairness to the Honourable Khademe. We've got an amendment in the A-list at the moment, proposing that life partner should be omitted from the text. In further reflection, we would like to submit to the committee that we see no rationale or reason why life partner should in any manner be distinguished from the spouse. If we have a look at the legislative frameworks dealing with that, in those acts that we referred to yesterday, so let's stop there then, Madam Chair. I think we would like to propose that the committee consider that we withdraw that amendment and that we make no distinction between a spouse and a life partner, whereas the... I'm sorry, Madam Chair. In particular, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. In particular, if we keep in mind that the law recognizes the one in the same manner as the other. So I'll leave it at that. I'm not showing a real issue here, which is the next one. But can we read it in there? So it's a member of the board, his or her spouse, life partner, immediate family member, or business partner, may not during the time that is a restraint of trade. It is not related to the application or the receipt of a grant. So after 24 months, cannot pick up employment with a company having received. Then, Madam Chair, after our discussion, this is where the DDG will come in now. It is our humble submission that this should not apply in respect of application or receipt of grants. This relates specifically to that relationship of confidentiality whilst the person is with the lotto and that period thereafter. But why should we not allow for the application or receipt of grants? I think the DDG should come in maybe and explain the policy stance.
So, the earlier one that was being raised on page 6, confidentiality and restraint of trade, in particular was referring to the commissioner. Now, the implication is that the commissioner is a board member.
Madam Chair, that's quite correct. It's on page 6 of the bill, and it's in line 32. There is a commissioner or the employee. Yes. I'm sorry for that reference. It's on page 6 and in line 32.
Page 8 specifically talks about a board member. And I'm not aware that the commissioner is a board member. That's what I said. Now, you know, we want the commissioner dealt with. I mean, the commissioner, am I right, members? Yes.
And if you know, that's quite correct. This debate relates to what we're having on page 6 in respect to the commissioner. Now, clearly, Madam Chair, I can only go that far because now it becomes purely a consideration of policy, and I'm not called upon to pronounce on that, Madam Chair.
Well, that's what the committee wants. DDG?
Chair, I think the proposal makes sense, but I think to the extent that we want to narrow it only to the commissioner, perhaps the committee can clarify the reason why the board member should not be in the same position as well as the member of the distributing agency. I think if you look at it practically, the commissioner does not really interact with the grant, does not make decisions on the grant. But I think if we are applying the principle, it should apply to the commissioner, the board member, as well as the member of the distributing agency. I think it should be in order, Chair.
What we are saying, DDG, is not that we don't want the board member or anyone else covered. We do. We're not having a problem with what is on page 8. We agree. All we're saying is, can we extrapolate that across to the commissioner? We want it also. We want the constraint of trade, the two-year issue, with respect to the grant, also to apply to the commissioner. So we want it as it is on page 8. Yes. But over here, we're talking about the commissioner per se. We're not saying that all the employees, you know, should get involved. We're saying that what you've got here, we have no problem with all the employees there. We have a problem with the top dog. That's what we're saying. Honourable Kadebi.
We understand what the committee is saying. I think we think what we're proposing is that it must be consistent also in the commissioner, but as well as the distributing agency members. So we are in agreement.
I've no doubt that that can be dealt with very simply. All right. Yes. Now.
Honourable Chair, I'm covered.
Yes.
Because the commissioner is playing a very critical role. Because a lot of influence, he or she might not take decisions, but he can set the pace of what is happening.
And there I was thinking I may become a commissioner one day. So, anyway, let us then move to page, that was page 6, which we went back to, and we're all covered there, yes. Page 7. Page 8. And we take your point, la partner, covered by statute, omitted, etc. Page 9 of the bill. Remember all the deletions or the omissions? Page 10. Honourable
Hill-Lewis? Yes, Jen, this is where the other questions become relevant.
Yes. I hear you. Just turn towards the DTI.
I'm sorry, but the other stage issue is giving me nightmares. But in regards to the two questions, the question 2, I think we've addressed the first question already. So question 2 was in relation to what will happen to the revenue generated by the state organ in the event that it's licensed to conduct the lottery, and how will the split be like. Chair, these are the things that will be in the agreement or the license agreement. As it is right now, obviously the how the revenue is utilized in terms of how much goes into the National Lottery Distribution Fund is not, we don't have a specific amount that we set out or a percentage. Normally the bidders will propose and will take whatever is in the interest of the NLDTF, but also the interest of the sustainability of the lottery. So currently what we're working with is a 34% from the previous bidder, which goes into a National Lottery Distribution Fund. So far, that becomes like your sort of your baseline in a way. So when we look at, you know, the future of how much goes into the NLDTF, obviously we'll consider how much comes at the moment. And whoever will give a much more, I think, a significant amount, you know, will be considered. But a number of issues are considered in that process. So it is not possible for us to say how much will go into the NLDTF. That is if I understand a split to mean that. But in terms of also its operations, we don't know. I mean, that company will put, because it's going to be a company that is set up and can only do the lottery. It cannot do other things. So it's going to be a company, or sorry, an entity or an organization that is only going to be running the lottery. That is the current requirement in the act, that even the new bidders, when they do bid, the company that they bid with should be a company that only does lottery, doesn't do other things. So the same requirements will apply in this case. And I think in our A list, it is the amendment that indicates that it will be established solely to run the lottery. So in regards to how it would look like, again, that is the question, in fact, that was asked to us by the potential bidders to say what structure should we have. We said we would not dictate to you how your structure should look like. All we know is that it must be an organization, a company that is set up specifically to run the lottery, and your efficiencies and whatever requirements should dictate how it looks like. All we want to see is that it will operate efficiently, it will give maximum proceeds to the NLDTF. How you structure it, whether it's a consortium or it's what, it's not our business. So we never know up until we see that treated. Instead, then we'll assess whether we think it will be effective or not. So, Chair, I think as much as we are attempting to respond to these questions, some of the things we cannot say how they should look like. Whether it's supposed to be a company headed by a CEO, or it's supposed to be a consortium of companies or whatever, we cannot say that. But we know that the requirements in the Lottery Act in terms of what should be a competency to run a lottery will be adhered to. And I think that is the point that we're making this morning around the areas around the Section 13.2, A and B, 2 and 3, to ensure that those things do not get diluted. That's the issue of skills, the issue of financial resources, human resources to deal with this, to run the lottery business will still be maintained. Thanks, Chair.
Right, are there any questions, Honourable Hill-Lewis?
Thank you very much for the answers. You see, I must say I do feel inherently uncomfortable about empowering the creation of a new entity without any detail, without knowing anything about what that entity is going to look like. Usually when we create a new entity in legislation, be it the BE Commission or whatever it is, the many new entities we created in recent legislation. We have a fair idea of what that's going to look like, how it's going to be controlled, whether it be by a board or whatever, who is going to head it, how that person is going to be appointed. All of those things are important for accountability and oversight, but we don't have any of those details in this legislation. We just know that some new entity will be created. So I am uncomfortable with that. Then just on the funding, this new entity, will it be funded from the DTI budget vote, or will it be self-funded from the NLDTF or from the revenue?
You
understand very well what the honourable member is saying, but I think the honourable member is understanding from this proposal that we are creating through this act an organ of state. That's not what we're doing. So the amendments are creating an enabling provision for the minister to be able to appoint an organ of state. And how it's going to look like when it's formed, wherever it's formed at that particular point, we are not dictating in this legislation. So in the same way that the minister can appoint a private company to operate, in this act we do not say how that company should look like, whether it should be a consortium of people, whether it should be a private company, whether it should be what. We are not dictating that. So we are not, in terms of this act, establishing that entity. But we are providing enabling provisions for the minister to be able to appoint an organ of state if he deems it appropriate based on the grounds that are inserted in here.
Right. And now that was page 10, moving on towards... Yeah. The funding. Let me just go through that one. Funding. We have the word funding. Mm. How will this organ of state be established? How will it be funded? I thought that the idea was that it was coming from its revenue. Let me not respond for the BDG, though.
The point I was making that when it gets to be established, how it's going to get the finance to run itself, those will be the things that will be determined when it gets to be established. For instance, in terms of the current provisions for a private company, we do not tell them where to get the money. They can go and borrow, they can go and make loans, they can, so we don't do that, but we know that the requirements are saying that you must have the financial resources to be able to run a lottery. So in this act, we do not say the money is going to come from the treasury or it's going to come from the department. We don't even know the appropriate organ of state at that time. We don't even know whether it will be created maybe in the Department of Public Enterprises. We don't know. How it's funded, that will be determined at that particular point. But we don't think those are the things that are needed in the air because we're not establishing that entity in the act.
Thank you, Chairman. To deal with that issue, I think that as proposed yesterday, that even the regulations which are going to be part of this act must be brought back to this particular committee. I think that when the process of establishing that entity starts, it takes off the ground, I think the committee must be reported to so that it can apply its oversight properly. I think that that's what it can do now. But understand right now that we are just creating an opportunity for a local state to be a licensee when coming to this issue. But when that time, because really it cannot even happen now, let's say the minister goes with this decision out, he gets a private company for that. It means that it is not urgent to establish that. But when the process of establishing that company starts, I think that it must be also be referred to this portfolio committee so that it can exercise oversight properly.
Right, I'm now going to pass from here, and when members come to the final process, if they continue to have a different opinion, then I think that would be the time to bring it in. Thank you. Page 11. Page 12 of the bill. Page 13. Thank you. 19. Page 20, well that's at page 19, because then we added, yes, let's see, 31, 33,
apology from Honourable Elvis James, Abasa, and Mariani Ambrosini, page 1. Page 2. Right. Funding Practice Alliance, that was all the continuation then of the Lottery Amendment Bill, page 3. Right. Thank you, Honourable Bena Mirva. Proposed, seconded by Honourable Hadebi. The other need to get to sign. Is that the print there? Right. Okay, how are we going to start on the BEEE? Are we in that position? Right. If we don't. Want us to finish these quickly. Pardon? No, no, we're doing it now. Honourable. Yes. No problem. Friday the 16th of August. Apologies, Honourable Elbert, Honourable James, Oriani, Amsini, and 3. Page 1. Page 2, we continued with the Lotteries Amendment Bill. Page 3. And we have someone to propose adoption. And thank you, Honourable Kobasa, seconded by the Honourable Vanda Mirva. Wednesday the 21st of August. Apologies from Honourable Oriani Ambrosini. Gosh, full house, eh? Page 1. Page 2. Page 3 is the register. I take it you're all checking that. Right. We have someone to propose adoption of Wednesday. Honourable Ma'ili, seconded by the Honourable Kobasa. And then we have Friday the 23rd of August. Apologies from the Honourable Elbert, Honourable Oriani Ambrosini, Honourable Singh, Honourable Ma'ili. Right, page 1. Page 2. The NEF came then, right? Page 2. Page 3. Right. Check the register. Got your Hansard attached. We have someone's proposed adoption. Honourable Hadebi, seconded by Honourable Kobasa. Now, we've gone, whoopsie, gone right out of week. I think that's it, the 23rd. Right. You'll be pleased you don't have to bring them to the next committee. Right, thank you for that, DG, for allowing us just to take that. And also, Ms. Jodie Scott. And we have a number of people with us here, just looking at the list today, trying to get the Lotteries Amendment Bill out the way.
From a committee point of view,
is probably 80% as we sit here. And that's not pointing any fingers at ETI. It's trying to get to grips with the process that we need to undertake, and I'm sure everyone understands that. But let's welcome other people who are here. We have, of course, acknowledged the COO, the DDG, but also the acting DDG, Garth Strachan, and the Chief Financial Officer, Shabir Khan, and Ministry, it just says here, doesn't it? Musa Ibrahim. Musai, yeah, because Musa, well, can't read the writing. All right. Thank you. Right. Can we move straight ahead? No interruptions. Who's taking up EG?
Yes, thank you, Honourable Chair. Just to put the Honourable Member Funder Merva, who made the passing comment at ease, that whilst we will be dealing substantially with the 2012-2013 annual report, many of the other ones, the detail of it, for example, the second quarter report, the MTF budget and the budget estimates, we included all of the detail in annexures, so I will be very, very quickly passing them over. I think the committee is used to this presentation, and as I said, we will have to cover our, especially our key work program and how we've worked towards our targets in these areas. Let me kick off firstly by setting the economic context in which the DTI's report should be situated. As you know, we try to shape economic events, but usually we are more shaped by what is happening in the global economy, especially that we are a small and very open economy with almost 50% covered by imports and exports of our GDP. So we're very vulnerable and open to global developments. And I think just a few points about the global economic development. It's firstly, there's the recovery for the first time, I think, maybe for probably the past 100 years, the recovery is led now by emerging markets. Always we had to rely on recovery in the US or in Europe to be able to drive economic growth. In 2012, the year under review, we see that that's led by Asia, but most importantly by Africa as well. As part of this, what the OECD says, there is a shift in the center of gravity. As we see, emerging economies grew at an average of 6.3%, and compared to 5.1% in 2012. And then if we look at the advanced economies, we can see the slow growth. And these are our main markets at the moment, still 1.6 and 1.3% over the period. In the future, from the IMF, we do expect a slight increase in the global growth from 3.2 to 3.5%. If we look at South Africa and our own economy, we see that, again, growth is quite modest, and it's... for the year 2012, it was 2.1%. And if we take it compared to, whilst it was an improvement from the year or the quarter before that, we see it still nowhere near the 5% that we reached before the crisis. I think this sort of graph gives you the general trend. As you can see, the impact of the Great Recession, as it's called, 2008-2009, we had a massive decline in GDP, and then as you can see, we are slowly on the road to recovery. Out of that, we're nowhere near the levels we reached before the growth rate before the financial crisis. The one positive development, if we look at the emerging trends, is that we see there's at least an improving role for the productive sector and especially for the manufacturing sector. We see manufacturing grew by 5.6% between 2010 and 2012. We see also subsectors that are now playing a bigger role in the economy, and some of it due to the interventions made by government and the department. We saw see increases in motor vehicles, especially transport equipment, and the chemical sector is in a sense leading this nascent revival of the manufacturing sector. But the key point on this slide we want to make is that there is a nascent recovery underway in the manufacturing sector. And I think it was clear that the intervention that was made, and especially with regard to the introduction of the manufacturing competitive enhancement package, a sort of a intervention we made to deal with a slowdown in the Eurozone, and also the MSEP, the second intervention that I think is starting to have an impact on the manufacturing sector, the designations and the use of government procurement to buy from domestic producers. Those two interventions, you will see later on in the program, I think those two interventions has had an impact on reviving the industry. That's just some of the job figures, but I think I'll rather just focus on the overall trend again with regard to employment. Again, as you see, whilst the trend is a positive one, that the job numbers are going up, but as you can see, it's a recovery from what we had a few years ago, but as you can see, we also nowhere near the rate of job creation we had. So that's the trend, as it is positive. We then look also at two other statistics. The one is which is called gross capital formation, which is really investment in the economy. We see there's an improvement in that, and then there is also an improvement in our merchandise exports from 150 billion to 170 billion. So there is an increase in a positive story with regard to exports, and again, whilst there's some diversification taking place, it is still predominantly our precious metals, base metals, steel, which dominates our export baskets, but more and more motor vehicles as a major export is entering our export basket and making a big contribution to our exports. And then I think just turning again to our biggest market, what we've said is that the bulk of our manufactured exports go to the European Union, and it was for that reason that we needed to look at the diversification strategy if we were going to maintain or at least expand our exports. And the markets we are now focusing on, and you will see later on in our trade and investment report, but the markets we're relying on are more and more on the continent, in Southeast Asia and the Middle East is where we're scaling up our efforts, and you will see the details of that later on. I think this slide finally just on is our imports and exports, and as I indicated, while you can see that that exports is going up, imports are going up even faster. So our trade deficit is expanding, and I think in conclusion we'd like to say that this probably is our central economic challenge, that we are consuming more than we are producing, and that trade deficit is now going towards about 5-6%, our biggest vulnerability. And so clearly you will see in our program, we're putting a lot of emphasis on growing our exports, but also replacing imports, especially where government purchases are concerned. But as you said, that whilst there's an improvement in our exports, there's also expansion of our imports. Then turning to the work of the department, as you're familiar with, the core of our program is industrial development, so the focus of this report focuses on that core area, but also we've got a very important role for broadening participation, so we will give you an update on what we are doing to create a more inclusive economy. And then the third big area of our work is the regulatory space, and there, as you can see, we are trying to make progress to create a beneficial environment with no red tape for our businesses to operate. That's the work program. Then I'll then turn to our achievements, starting off, as I said, with our core business, which is industrial revitalization and industrial development. I think the positive thing for the year under review, as you know, in our automotive industry, we've always had the big, let's say, the big five or big seven, Toyota, Mercedes-Benz, BMW, General Motors in the country. But the really positive development now is the emergence of China's auto OEMs into the South African market. First Automotive Works, which is a Chinese company, is a truck plant. They are well underway with the construction of that plant, and it should be completed by the end of this year and go into production sometime in the new year. But that was a major achievement, that we started drawing Chinese investment into the automotive, but also into an industrial development zone. And that's led to the revitalization of our IDZs. The other big one is the Beijing Automotive Works, which also they built a taxi plant. As you know, we were importing all our taxis from Japan before this, and this is the intervention. Similarly, we've also seen Toyota also brought on stream the local production of taxis. So as you can see, the consolidation in the automotive sector, and then the minister also released the electric vehicle roadmap. As you know, that is the new hybrids, and electric vehicles are going to be a growing part of the sector, and we're trying to position ourselves to be not only an importer, but a producer of the new electric vehicles. The other sector which is important that our interventions was in the clothing and textile industry. As you know, we have been operating the clothing and textile competitiveness program. The achievement there is that for a sector that has been losing many, many jobs, we've now stabilized the industry but also created 12,200 new jobs in a very vulnerable sector. And then also we see really positive developments in the footwear industry. As you know, this sector is also very open and to imports, and it's one of the most vulnerable sectors, and we see companies like Edels and others now expanding, and we see production of shoes should move up to 100 million in the next 3 years. So as the autos, clothing, then in the agro-processing sector, we also see developments, but just to mention the one incentive we introduced in the year under review is the aquaculture development program. As we know, in terms of, let's say, fish farming is the fastest growing demand for food, and we're trying to develop that sector through this program. I think if one just looks at some of the other developments in the industrial development area, as I indicated earlier, we introduced the Manufacturing Competitive Enhancement Program in May 2012. As I said, it was an intervention to save our industry from decline, given the decline in exports to Europe. And there we managed to help 189 enterprises with grants of just under 1 billion rand. And we managed to therefore retain our industrial capacity and maintain 33,000 jobs. In terms of the 12i program, that's the tax incentive program, we supported projects over 10 billion. And then the designations, we started to expand the list of sectors where we're saying that government, SOEs, provinces, municipalities must procure local. And there we issued the designations for furniture, which is a labor-intensive product, pharmaceuticals, solar water heaters, and also in the power and telecom sector. So as you can see, we were steadily expanding the list of goods where we used to rely on imports, and now we're getting local production growing. And then the SPY program is for innovations, and the TRIP is the program for where we support students at university, students and researchers, and the figures are there. The other industry where I think we've had a positive impact on is the film industry, and as you can see, we are now developing strong capabilities in the sector, 70 film production supported, but also we're starting to get into animated films like Kumba, which had, but also I think we will see later in the other film that we support, which is The Long Walk to Freedom, which is a locally financed but also locally produced movie, but I think that if there's one sector that is really sort of is coming to its own, it's the film industry, and the other sector is the business processing outsourcing, We've got, as we said, the skills development program for young people under the Monyetla program, where we train 3,800 learners. But again, there you can see the amount of investments. And then we achieved the award for best offshoring destination in the UK under that. So as you can see with industrial development, whilst I think we haven't restructured the let's say the manufacturing sector as a whole, I think the four key sectors we have transformed and stabilized, that's autos, clothing, and in BPOs and film industries. This then is just an overview of the incentive we paid out during the year and a review. As you can see, the bulk of the firms we out is small, medium enterprises under the EIP, Enterprise Investment Program, the tourism program, and in the AIS, the Automotive Incentive Scheme, which to the auto industry's BPS, is business processing services, the fulfillment out of 12 IS, it is the tax incentive. The CIP is the critical infrastructure program. This is where we, around the investment, we sometimes assist with the development of a road or a dam or other supporting infrastructure. We supported SIG projects, and as I indicated then, the new program under that list is the MZ program, and so that's the companies we supported. Then the other set of incentives is what we call our broadening participation incentives, which is really the main one. There is 1,200 firms out, that's the BBSDP, that's the Black Business Supply Development Program, and then CIS, the Cooperative Incentive Program. These two programs have been a growing part of our budget as we try to, as I said, create an inclusive economy, get new players into the industrial economy especially. And the EMEA program is our export marketing assistance program. This is part of our diversification strategy. So we assisted just over 1,000 firms with regard to export marketing. This is where we get companies to go to trade fairs and to participate in exhibitions. Then turning to investment and export promotion, we've achieved exports of 53 billion. We've also achieved 3.8 billion with regards to investment projects. You can see the breakdown of our investment portfolio. One can see the growing role now of Asia within the investment portfolio, 61% in that area. And then just the last final point to mention is, as I indicated, we are trying to diversify, and we have now, this would be the second year in which we took companies to China. 61 companies was taken in the first 6 months. They got exports going to 35 million. We currently also have about 80 companies who just come back from their 2013 visit, but on an annual basis, we're trying to take many, many new exporters to the Chinese market. We've also continued our work, especially with regard to the BRICS. In the year under review, we hosted the BRICS State Ministers meeting March in Durban. And the only final point to make under this part of multilateral is the EPA negotiations, which are currently underway as we speak. But at least we've tried to make a breakthrough. We've made a breakthrough in this negotiation in that all of those toxic provisions which limited our policy space has been removed or completely, let's say, diluted by the EU. And then we've also tried to make a deal where we would give some of our GIs in exchange for greater market access for our agricultural products. So that is the deal we're hoping to get in the EPAS, is expanded access for our agricultural products in exchange for giving them protection for their GIs. But lots of work was being done, and hopefully by the end of this year, this negotiations will be concluded. Then the other major work in the area of trade has been moving fast on the area of the tripartite free trade area. We've managed to both within SADC and within SACU, create a common mandating position and play the leading role in developing that so that we can have a coherent approach towards the tripartite area. Also, we are actively engaged in the work on the North-South Corridor. We have a committee chaired by DGI and Durco where we're trying to ensure that the Dar es Salaam to Durban road and rail network and what we have proposed as DGI and we have the support of our colleagues is to create a treaty between the 10 countries that span this trade corridor so that we can, as I said, move our goods and services onto the continent and diversify our exports. We've been active with regard to bilateral engagements. Basically, what it is as you know, under the free trade area agreement, there's three legs to it. There's a trade negotiations where we take away tariff barriers. The second part is the industrial policy leg where we try and increase production. And the third leg is infrastructure. Now, the third leg is to see that because the greatest impediment to trade on continent is the absence of road and rail networks. So what the North-South Corridor is, a project of about 10 countries of being from, as I said, in Tanzania, Dar es Salaam, through Malawi, Zimbabwe, Zambia, right to Durban. So what we need, because we want to have one corridor, we need to have agreements between different countries. And so this memorandum of understanding is a treaty that we propose that the 10 countries sign and that to agree to cooperate on different legs of this massive rate bundle. So that is what the MOU is. We've done a draft treaty or MOU which is currently before our cabinet for endorsement and we've also, Durco has also distributed to all the other countries for discussion on that. But it will then lay a firm foundation for us to proceed with the construction phase of this program. These are the other, as you said, we've conducted many technical business missions. Many of them are on the continent. And this is where we find we can have, there's possibilities for export of locomotives, of trains, of other transport equipment, and we get this through these technical missions, but also our bilateral engagements continue. The one area, or new area, is Indonesia, as you know, is a major, major market in Asia that is also growing quite fast. Turning then to, as I said, we've covered industrial development and we've covered trade and investment. The other, as I said, big work program of the department is broadening participation or, let's say, inclusivity in the economy. Our main focus has been the CEDA technology program and the creation of new incubators. We currently have the 42 incubation centers, which is supported under our program, but we're starting to expand our incubators. And there, 8 new incubators was approved in the year under review. We also continue our work with regard to women and gender empowerment and the Isibandi Women's Fund supported 20 new projects. And as I said, we're getting close to completion now in terms of the year under review. The youth enterprise is the other focus of our work where we're going to develop dedicated incentive programs targeting young entrepreneurs. The Workplace Challenge Program, similarly, we're trying to expand it not only from formal manufacturing enterprises, but also to cover cooperatives now, and they've assisted 80 cooperatives in that area. As I said, that old productivity enhancement program, which we've been running in the formal sector for a while, but now it's been expanded. Then turning to the other major area, which is the SOTWAS division, which is dealing with regulation. As you can see, they've been keeping yourselves very occupied with all the, firstly, policy frameworks. They've been doing work around the licensing of businesses, National Credit Act, intellectual property, and the policy frameworks have been developed. But also there's the bills, which I think I won't spend a lot of time in. You are very, very familiar with all of them, lotteries and so on, special economic zones. And thanks to the cooperative amendment bill has been finalized in the year under review, but also it was on the 5th or 6th of August, it was signed into law by the President. Currently, as we know, lots of work was done on the BE amendment bill that was also completed by yourselves, and it's now in Section 76 in the province. And then we've also completed the work on the legal metrology, which again you're familiar with and is now also currently before you. So as you can see, it's been busy on the legislative front. And then finally turning to administration, we have the vacancy rate has come down whilst we haven't met our target, which we set a target of 5%. But because of the number of new positions we created, we only managed to get to 8%, but at least below the 10% range. Our targets on disability has been achieved, and this was asked about last year in our presentation, is 2.8%. Also with regard to women in senior management, we're currently at 43% with regard to women in senior management. Amongst the departments, we are in the top quartile or the top decile with regard to our performance with regard to women in senior management. Also, we're also in the top with regard to payments. We've paid all our suppliers within 30 days, if not within 15 days, and so on. And then, of course, the DDI entities is the other part that we developed a clear policy now to deal with the risk of non-performance in the entities. I then just want to quickly, there's a full annexure on this issue of our performance information. But also yesterday or the day before, you got a report from the Auditor General, and this is with regard to our targets. As you know, we achieved, out of 56 targets, we achieved 36, and we only partially achieved 20, or let's say not achieved 20. I think what we have attached is a full annexure, and it's really to explain where we haven't fully achieved, and the most of the underachievement is in the area of the automotive incentive scheme, where, as I said, we set up a certain amount where we hope to assist so many companies. Companies didn't undertake the new models at the pace we would like, and so there's underachievement in the automotive scheme, and so on. But so, as I said, the details are on there, but we're constantly monitoring our achievements, our performance. If I can turn into the financial management system, I think this, we've tried to just condense the amount of information on this, and I think this slide will just capture the biggest concern that you've raised previously is the level of underspending in the department. And if you can take at least the steady and continuous improvement, if we take just 2 years ago in 2010, 2011, our underspending 6.4%. It went down the year before, 2011, 2012, to 1.1%, and now we have brought it down to 0.77%. So there is an improvement, and we're almost, let's say, spending what we're receiving. This just gives you then a breakdown of the variances. As I indicated there, you will see under the industrial development incentive, of the 64 million underspending, industrial development incentive administration, and that is said again, is mainly the automotive incentive scheme, which is 36 million was underspent in that that area, and that is accounts for the level of underspending. In the variances is given as per the item. You do, one shouldn't add up those percentages, but it's the proportion within that line item of underspending. But as I said, we've achieved 64 million underspending. This also gives the breakdown of our actual expenditure and the various, if we look at the different categories, and as I said, it's mainly for payment for capital assets. Then, if I can start heading to conclusion, but looking at the audit outcomes and interventions coming out of our Auditor General report, again, we've tried to encapsulate on one slide the progress we're making with regard to audit outcomes. Firstly, to say that we have, for the 2012-2013 financial year, we've received a financially unqualified audit opinion. But as you know, there are still findings that have been raised. Now, the red bar is where there are findings, and the green is no findings. So if we take 2010-11, you can see there's about five or six blocks which there were findings on, and there were six findings. In 11-12, again, there was a number of findings, and we've now, in this year, we've reduced it to two areas where there are findings. So as you know, once you have totally green, then you have a clean audit. Not only an unqualified audit opinion, but you also have a clean audit. So again, I think in terms of our minister's injunction, that continuous improvement should be the way in which we approach things. As I said, we've reduced it, and it's mainly in the area of supply chain management for procurement under 500,000. So all the big vendors and all those things, there's no problems, no findings in that area. So it's all for the small, or as it was called, the Kigali hotel challenge. Again, so what are we doing? As I said, it's mainly the audit findings, mainly related to the goods and services under 500,000, and then the accounting officer not taking enough steps to prevent that. So our entire program now, and our CFO, Shabir, is fully charged with this responsibility, where we're doing a number of training interventions, we're issuing a number of instruction notes, and so on. We're also having meetings with the people, not only in the finance department, but in the division to actually do the spending, for them to really get this under control, where they must get the three invoices. If they don't get the three, they must put in place mechanisms to try to obtain those three invoices. And as I said, and if it's not possible to get a proper deviation signed, you can say, in this area, it's not possible to get three definitions, but then to get the necessary delegations and so on. So this is our main area that we need to work on if we're going to get towards a clean audit. But on the whole, as I said, there is progress with regard to that. Let me then finally turn, before getting to the third second quarter report, I think if one just summarizes the challenges emerging from the 2012-2013. I think the biggest impact on the work of the DTI has been the slowdown in the manufacturing sector caused by the loss of our traditional markets, or decline in exports to our traditional markets, especially Europe. And our main challenge for the years ahead is going to be diversification of trade, especially onto the continent. Second biggest challenge we face is around this broadening participation leg of our work. As you know, we have this, we've inherited this dualism in our economy, where there's a real gap between the formal enterprises, big businesses, and township businesses. There's a massive divide and so on. So we, as I said, we've started with BBSDP, cooperative incentives, but we hope to really make a big impact in this area, but it's really to integrate it. But also in the agricultural sector, is to get commercial farmers or big commercial farmers to get integrated with black small-scale farmers, so that we start building an inclusive economy. That's really the central challenge coming out of our work. And then the final thing is, whilst we made progress with regards to designations, there isn't yet a culture within the whole and all tiers of government and all departments and SOEs and even and especially the private sector, there isn't a culture of buying local and supporting local producers. If you go to other countries like South Korea, the only car you see there is Hyundai. There are no Mercedes-Benzes. There are no, they don't really build their local capabilities. But even in, as I said, even in the vast economies like Germany and so on, all the locomotives are done locally. So it's really, that's going to be our biggest chance to create an entire culture around local procurement and therefore local jobs. If I can then very quickly, Madam Chair, turn to the other, you've asked us to deal with just very quickly the adjustment estimates. As I said, it's a full annexure given, but really we are simply trying to, in our adjustment estimates, we are simply trying to reprioritize. For example, from our automotive incentive scheme, where there's slight underspending, to maybe small business support. So we're just trying to restructure our incentives, but we need an environment from Treasury and so on. But they have not sought any additional funds to National Treasury for unforeseeable, unavoidable. It's a reprioritization that we dealt with in our adjustment estimate. But there's a clear breakdown in this slide. And then if we take the medium-term expenditure framework for 2014-15, which again you've asked us to do, we've given a detailed annexure on what that entails. But really the key request we're making for MTF is to finance the new entities that we have to establish under the legislation. As I've just mentioned, the Cooperative Development Act has been passed, and now we need to set up the Cooperative Development Agency, the Cooperative Tribunal, and the Cooperative Apex Organization. And that our main request is in that area, and also with regards to, let's say, office and the building renovations we have to do for staff. As I said, that's the MTF. This also just gives you the detailed breakdown of our current allocations. We're moving from, let's say, 9.9 baseline to 1.3 extra, which takes us 11 billion for our revised baseline. That's the MTF, but from what we understand is that the budget is going to be very tight given the different tax revenues, the mining problems in the mining sector and so on. So we don't expect any major adjustment for 2014-2015, but hopefully we will definitely hope to maintain our baseline and then to expand it slightly to find new priorities, especially in broadening participation. And then finally, Madam Chair, you've asked us to also then cover in this presentation second quarter highlights for 2013. I think, again, I'm going to go very quickly through this. Firstly, the important intervention to support our localization program, the designation program. The South African Bureau of Standards has now sent a local content verification office so that companies, for example, under renewable energy, we have a specification that 65% of the renewable energy must be locally procured. So in terms of verifying what is the local content, we've now got a dedicated office within Bureau of Standards to do that. Like I said, we're moving into locomotives and so on, and it's important that we have the infrastructure in place to monitor our local content. Also, we're moving into the rolling stock, the locomotives, but also the manufacture of buses. There's been very good work with both Johannesburg, Cape Town, and Tshwane with regard to the rail system, but all those buses are now being bought locally. Similarly, with the pharmaceutical area, the family planning tender has been awarded to local manufacturers, but also the anti-TB tender, also bulk COVID is now locally procured. We've also issued the instruction notes, as you know, after we do the designation, National Treasury must then, or we work with National Treasury to issue the instruction notes, which gives it to every procurement officer on how much must be procured locally, so that it goes down to provinces, municipalities, the SOEs, and so on. And we've completed those instruction notes now for power, telecom cables, solar water heaters during the period under review. We've also worked, as you know, with the rollout of the renewable energy program. We've completed solar PV localization roadmap. And as you can see, number of the solar PV projects, it is now being locally made solar panels made in South Africa. But the last interesting initiative, which is a real breakthrough, is working with the low-end retailer, Mr. Prices. As you recall, it was Mr. Prices that decided to go on the import route and diverted from the old sort of Woolworths strategy of using local, and that led to the decline of the footwear industry. So after Fushini now, Mr. Prices is also working with us in our program to ensure that they also procure locally, and that is one of the biggest boosts to the clothing textile sector. We're also working on the standards area, and we're looking at the continent, and we set up the Pan-African quality infrastructure, and our agencies are playing the key roles in providing secretarial and support services on the continent. Below is just the projects done under this year now, the FOLM, the MCEP, 87 projects, and as you can see, the pipelines is proceeding under these programs. This is again just a quarter two with regard to trade investments. I think the important point to emphasize here is the AGOA initiative, and as you know, currently the minister is in the U.S. heading his trip today, but it's really to ensure we've been working over the past year or past 6 months with trying to get AGOA renewed, and then there's a lobbying campaign under we've been busy with, and it's culminating in this week's trip to the U.S., and it appears positive. That we will get some kind of extension. I think that covers trade investment and exports. I think, again, you're familiar with this second quarter work. As we know, we've finalized now the public comments on the codes of good practice, not the legislation, but the codes of good practice, and that will also be issued hopefully at the BE Summit, which is scheduled for the first week of October. We've also introduced a Bachelor of Economic Development degree at the University of the Western Cape. As you know, we currently have an honors and master's program at Wits University, where we sort of getting into the new economics of industrial policy, and this is now extending to University of the Western Cape. We've approved 30 incubators, and as I said, this is a new incentive scheme which was introduced last year, the incubation support program, and that is proceeding similarly with our growing CIS and PPSDP program. Again, with the legislation and regulation, as I said, the Cooperative Act was assented to in August. The BE bill was classified as Section 76, which means that we consultation with all the provinces, and that work was undertaken, and I think as of this week now, nine of the provinces have they've all completed their work, and it will go for, in the next 2 weeks, it will be finalized in the NCOP. The licensing bill is currently under consultations, we just dealt with the lobbies amendment bill. There's, as you know, we've issued the policy framework for the credit amendment bill, and also we've released the framework for intellectual property as well. So that there's also been quite activity in the CCRD section and so on. This is also, again, our expenditure. Again, because it's only in the second quarter, one can't draw too many conclusions from this, but our variance is at 14%. But as I said, things, as I said, pick up in the last quarter and so on. So I think it's too difficult to make anything specific here. So, Madam Chair, that covers the annual report and the second quarter report for 2013. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, DD. And one welcomes the comprehensive approach here, because it certainly assists us as we begin to analyze and then finally prepare our oversight report in this. Thank you very, very much indeed. Members, it's over to yourselves now. Honourable James, Honourable Thring, Honourable Van der Merwe, Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable Wyden, Honourable Habebe, bringing up the rear, Honourable McIntosh. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you to Mr. October for his comprehensive review. I have a number of comments, but I'm just going to focus on one, which I believe is a weakness in the department, and that has to do with IP, the extent to which DTI is looking after intellectual property. Now, there are two issues I'd like to comment on. The first, in terms of the changes you want to bring about, the first one has to do with the protection of indigenous knowledge. And my view is well known that the IBLAB does not protect indigenous knowledge, and it at the same time corrupts the existing IP system. So it dilutes it. So, and so that's one issue. The second issue is to do with the Cabinet's approved IP policy document. It is, first of all, a very good initiative to try and coordinate IP. It's been difficult to do that because there's lots of competing interests in that space, but it is important for coordination between health and agriculture and DTI and other departments, and DSE, of course, which is at the heart of the IEP system in some ways, for coordination to take place. So I agree with that. The second thing I agree with is that you're trying in the health area create the room for generics, so that drugs that come off patent should be kept off patent in order to make generics cheap and accessible to people. But the problem is that our burden of disease is infectious disease. For infectious disease, that's for animal and plant and human health. You require vaccines, and vaccines are not generics, and vaccines can never be generics. And it takes an enormous amount of money to find a vaccine for extensively resistant TB, for example, which is a bacterial infection. HIV is just an impossibility scientifically right now, but it takes an enormous amount of money, and it usually involves your big pharma. So it's a big pharmaceutical company who can put out $2 billion in order to develop a vaccine in the longer term. And so just in brief, the action is not around generics. The action is around vaccines, on the one hand for infectious disease, and then it's for cellular-based disease like cancer. So you can't have generics for cancer treatment. And so the investment in terms of cancer, which is uncontrolled cell duplication, in order to deal with that, you require massive investments as well. So, and for that, you need a robust IP system. No big pharmaceutical company is going to put $2 billion into a vaccine development or a cancer treatment if they can't protect the IP. It doesn't work that way. So it's very, very important that we protect the IP system. And the area of health is about patent protection over chemical compounds that are unique in order to deal with it. Just on the animal health side is really important. You know, we get a new flu strain that comes through. The last one was the H7N1. Just by the way, the H stands for hemagglutinin, which is a dangerous protein, and the N stands for neuraminidase, which is also a dangerous protein, and they combine, in swine and birds. They come along, they destroy ostriches. What do? We kill ostriches. There's nothing else we can do. But goodness me, what does that do to our export into our ostrich business? Why don't we invest in developing a vaccine to deal with it? For that, you need an enormous amount of money. When it comes to plant health, we export grapes. You know, there's bugs that attack grapes and vineyards. With climate change, you have a shift in the rainfall patterns. Grapes don't like rainfall. They are irrigated. But it creates a different epidemiology for the bugs that attack the vineyards. So what we require is a vaccine to deal with that as well. Because if we don't have it, we will have less grapes to export. So just in brief, colleagues, I don't mean to give a lecture, but I just want to underscore that it's of the greatest importance that we look after our IP system. And I believe that DTI has great weaknesses in terms of the quality of personnel that you have in your department to look after the IP system. And I'll just leave it at that. It's a weakness in that department, in your department, and it's one you cannot afford, and you need to do something about it.
Right. Thank you, Honourable James. Honourable Thring.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I think firstly, just again from the ACDP, a big thank you to the Department for a well-presented presentation. Some concerns. We have lamented for some time, and certainly if one looks at trends on the our current account deficit and balance of payments, certainly for the last 2-3 years, it's concerning that the deficit continues to widen. You know, this is something that we have seen, and I think economists have spoken about the widening trend, certainly post the Great Recession. And I know that interventions have been put in place to look at reducing that by diversifying and moving away from the so-called our favorite markets, which have been Europe, but it seems as if the process has been quite slow. So with the widening gap on the current account deficit, I'm seeing some of the work that has been done to try to narrow that. When do you think that current account deficit? When should we start seeing the narrowing of that? particularly in the light also that we have a due deficit. It's not just the current amount deficit, but we also have a challenge with regard to our national deficit as well. So the due deficit, and if we continue to have these kinds of deficits, it doesn't bode well for the economy. I think that the second concern that we have is with regards to beneficiation. It is government policy that we aggressively, I would think, look at implementing beneficiation policy. Now, my question is, how much of our raw materials are we still exporting and then importing after they have been refined? And you know, that trend certainly ought to be coming down if we are serious about beneficiation. And maybe if there can also be just some kind of input with regards to, some kind of comment with regards to, have we, for example, in the jewelry, let's take the jewelry sector, have we identified potential students and have we taken them for training to, I don't know, Israel, India, you know, who are the ones who would beneficiate on our behalf and then export that to us. So is the, are the identified projects, and are we seeing some success in that? And then finally, Jay, I'm pleased to see that there are some incubator projects that we have, for example, within the textile industry, within the motor manufacturing industry. I'm just interested to note or to find out whether this is transferred right down to local government. When I served at Etiquini, we courted the textile industry. We had incubator projects and we invested money into some of those incubator projects, those sectors that were struggling to preserve jobs and to ensure that, you know, people don't lose their jobs unnecessarily. So the question then is, how broadly is this undertaken at a local government level? Because it's one thing doing it at national, but local government certainly ought to be one of the key players in terms of carrying out that kind of policy. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Ring. Honourable Brenda Merver.
Chair, thank you very much. And I too want to thank the DG for a very good presentation, given the number of slides he had. But really, it was more than one presentation, so we'll give you a little bit of leeway, but it was very well done. There's a lot to be said, and I think there's a lot of progress that has been made, and I really think that it's a very encouraging report. There's one thing in the annual report that I wanted to pick up on, because I think one of the areas where South Africa has got a problem is that we don't speak as Team South Africa. And I have noticed that you have 45 missions abroad. That's in 45, not in 45 separate countries necessarily, because like in China you've got two, but three actually with Hong Kong, but 45 missions altogether. What we hear a lot from people trying to do business abroad is that business people are doing one thing, the embassies are doing another, and trade industry is doing yet another. And I think it's important that the department looks at a way of making South Africa a team. You know, I understand it's not only your responsibility; it has to be an engagement with business as well. Because when I was in foreign affairs, we found that the only time businesses ever contacted us was when they were arrested or something like that. You know, they ever came to us and said, "We want to do business. What is the lowdown?" In the reverse, business say to us, sometimes I ask for an appointment with the ambassador when I go with a big project in China or something, and he's or she not prepared to see me. So there's a disjuncture. On this report, the annual report, I see there's 18 vacancies on your presumably fund vacancies on your postings abroad, and I think that is one of the ways that is one thing that has to be addressed. But there must be an initiative, I think, to bring every South African on board with our objective to implement the National Development Plan to 2030, and one of the ways is investment abroad. Thanks very much.
Great. Thank you, Honourable Van der Merwe. Honourable Wiley.
Thanks very much, Comrade Chairperson, and let's also applaud and appreciate the presentation made by the DGI, because it begins to give us a sense as to where are we, but also what is the international context under which we want to make a social progress. But few areas which I want to highlight for clarity. One, that the country has not been immune from the global economic crisis, and as a result, the government has managed to set aside a kind of the stimulus fund in terms of intervening to the distressed industries. But also, the intention was to ensure as well that we save some of the jobs that were lost during that particular process. I would like to have a sense as to what has been the successes and the shortcomings of that particular process, and how many companies across the industries that were saved and the number of jobs that have been saved as well. The second area, which relates to the global context as well, you have made mention that we've got a strong market in the EU, but if you take into consideration now a number of challenges in terms of the crisis in the EU that affects even other member states, and what are the threats that are facing South Africa? I'm raising this thing because if you look in terms of the distance and the logistic cost, we are far away from those particular markets. Are there any other alternative measures that are in place in ensuring that any economic shocks that may arise as a result of the crisis, then South Africa will be able to respond timeously, but also without having negative impact into our economy. The third component relates to the electricity. There are a number of industries which are categorized as the heavy electricity users. And I know that some of those companies are based in the Eastern Cape, and they are multinational, some of them, and some of them were threatening to close down because they could not be able to sustain the production, especially under the current climate, because you face with global economic crisis. The cost of electricity is increasing, especially for those particular sectors. And as a result, number of jobs, not on the industry itself, but in the value chains, have been negatively affected. I think it's an issue that may not need only the Department of Trade and Industry. It requires the multiplicity of stakeholders. I think the last one relates to the common approach and framework of negotiating some of these deals. I still remember that I experienced a lot of challenges. I was the executive mayor, Nelson Mandela, when we negotiated the FAW deal with Kuga. It was not only the Nelson Mandela Metro. You would find that there were other municipalities as well who were negotiating with the FAW. And some of the municipalities were promising investors that they will get free land. How to ensure that we develop a common framework for all spheres of government so that we don't give different signals to the foreign investors when we engage them? Is there any comprehensive package in terms of incentives, which must be a model that guides all of ourselves Because if we can't manage that particular situation, they have far-reaching implications for both South Africa, but also in some of their regions. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Honourable Waye. Honourable McIntosh.
Madam Chair, I have one comment and two questions. On page four...
We do want to hear you.
I've got, as I said, one comment and two questions. On page four, I just want to... And I'm very conscious that our minister is in America at the moment trying, I don't know if he's come back today or something, but negotiating and lobbying for AGOA. But what I think we must understand, and we mustn't forget it, is no matter how much we may be pleased, and rightly so, that emerging economies and BRICS are making more and more contributions, I myself, Madam Chair, was astonished to see the impact simply of Bernanke from the US Federal Reserve saying that he was going to calm down on what I think is now called tapering or something. But basically, the US was going to drop it. Our stock exchange went up, the world stock exchange went up, our rand strengthened. So, Madam Chair, let's remember, just as in a sense we are the gorilla in the garden of African economy, the US is the gorilla in the garden of the world economy. So let's not underplay the importance of the US. The questions I've got is page 12 of the report is showing the difference between imports and exports, and I just wondered if the Director General hasn't possibly thinking that gap may be a good thing if our manufacturing sector is buying more machinery and tools. So, I mean, it may be bad, but hopefully it's not a permanent trend. We hope it isn't that you're buying more cell phones. The second question is, where is the Beijing automated works located? I mean, where is this factory that's going to make taxis for Africa? The Beijing automated works. You don't mention which part of South Africa it's located in. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. When coming to the issue of this report, I think that it is a good vote, that's the first instance. And then number two, I think that as the portfolio committee, we have to congratulate the department in particular by being rated by Department of Performance as one of the best performing departments in the whole government. I think on that full regard, they must be uploaded. Chair, the issue here is the issue of industrialization. I think that it is very good to see that the fruits of the various iterations of industrial policy systems are bearing fruit. And in order to say that, because we can see that there is no way we are going to deal with the widening current account deficit unless we produce more and export more. So that's the bottom line. So it is really encouraging that the issue of industrialization is still at the center. Take into cognizance the fact that even the Europe itself has also realized that industrialization is at the core of development. That's why the fortunes of England itself have changed around. Because now they are producing more. They have seen that they made a mistake by dumping industrialization. So they are doing that. I think that the member that this government was able to have the foresight that the only way of turning around the economy is to re-industrialize the economy. It was a good position. So it must be taken going forward. But what is important, Chairperson, is that as you industrialists produce more, the wealth must be shared. That's the fiscal aspect. So I'll go to the issue of the broadening participation. The National Development Bank is very clear that at least by 2030, the cooperatives in the agricultural sector must be supplying 40% of the produce. But when we are speaking, as we are speaking now, the government procurement on the issue of food is around 40%. Not around 40%, it's 7 billion. It's 7 billion. What the government is procuring for food can be either be school nutrition, hospitals, correctional services. The total spend, the government spend on food is 7 billion. So the question is, of all the cooperatives which are registered within the department, how many are in that supply chain? How much percentage is there? Are we going to be able to reach the target of 40% by 2030? And then again, apart from the cooperatives, there are also small-scale farmers who have also must be accommodated. So in that one is something which is very easy. Is there a government spend there of 7 billion food only? And then when you look at APAP, the issue of agriculture, agro-processing, is one of the central things we wish are there. So how much is the government spending on the issue of the cooperatives here? And then the other issue is the issue of the cooperation between the various departments. In particular, the Department of Home Affairs, Chairperson. A person has met a lot of ambassadors from the different countries. Can be Japan, China, India. There's one thing which is common about them. But it is a nightmare to get papers to come and invest in South Africa. It is a nightmare. That's what they are crying about. It is a nightmare to get papers to come to invest in South Africa. So I don't know what relationship the department is having with Home Affairs. How are they going to ensure that they are special, they must be special permits to deal with that name? Because we cannot, even in my constituency, there was a good investment from India on the oil plant, cooking oil plant. The manager there had to go back because the papers were not in order. So I don't know how does the Department of Trade help on that particular regard. Because those guys are there to invest. They're not tourists. They're here as investors. So what relationship is there? How can they help out of that? And then, all right. Chairperson, please go ahead.
Right, thank you very much. I think you did need to go on as well, but I think most of us need a bit of water, including yourself, Honourable Khademi. But look, we were hoping at this point, I was looking out for the committee assistant, who's trying to find her way down in the dock or something. She'll take some time to get here. But we will acknowledge the school from Johannesburg, come a long way, come and see what Parliament does. And this is a very, very important process that we're undertaking now. This is the DG here from Trade and Industry, Mr. Lionel October. The DDG here, Ms. Zodwa Ntuli. Of course, the whole team, even Mr. Jerry Schultz there, the Chief Operating Officer. So why are they here, all these financial people and Mr. Khan? Because you want to know, your parents want to know, you're not yet earning a salary, I take it. You're busy learning, earn a salary. So your parents are wondering where their tax money goes. All right? Where does our money go? You hear them complaining over the dinner table. Now, we're telling you where that money goes, and you noticed here that when people spoke about performance, even though there are certain challenges, you had the ANC here and the DA here, and I'm sure the ACDP, Mr. Thring, shares that view. This is the best performing department in the government. So you're very fortunate to be here today with a little bit of good news happening. So now we're going to just give you the name of your school. Well, to the members here, take some time to get the name. Right. It says the Naturena Primary School. I happen to know where that is. It's in Johannesburg South, isn't it? Yeah, that was one of my constituents. Johannesburg, Gauteng. Now, thank you very much for visiting Parliament. And this, as you see, we've got many of the political parties here. ANC, DA, and the ACDP. And then start to get, just sitting behind the ACDP, there is Pope. So you can see democracy now. You can also tell your parents that the money in GTI has been well spent. Right. So to get back to this, I just have a couple of questions myself here. You know, I looked here, and yes, I see that you actually increased the number of projects for the ISTE under Women's Fund. You exceeded the target. Well done there. But on the youth, you know, I see that plan is still being baked, sort of still in the oven somewhere, not really come out yet. Is that right, GDG? You know, so maybe it's because it's a bit complex and you're working on that. And the other issue here, that notwithstanding all the positives we have said here this morning, there's absolutely no doubt that you have got the unqualified report and we congratulate you, but there are still areas that do need, you do need to focus on. I mean, you know, there are inadequate controls in certain of the areas, notwithstanding under 500,000, but that we do need to tighten on the compliance there. You know, now that you've got Mr. Khan from the AD, former AD, you know, there, weren't you? That you should be able to do that without any challenge. But we do welcome the relationship you've developed with Treasury, and this is certainly helping us to smooth things along. But I think a similar relationship will have to be developed with Home Affairs, and I think this is what members are pointing to. I don't want to point to too much. A lot has been raised here, but do go ahead, please. Thank you.
Yeah, I think you're trying to marginalize me.
I'd never do that, Honourable Hill Lewis, but here you are, and you see you would never rely. Honourable Hill Lewis.
Thank you very much. I know you've received a lot of questions, but I have just a few more. Firstly, let me add my voice to the voice of congratulations. You've got an unqualified audit. Well done. I've read through the AG's report as to why you didn't get a clean audit. And frankly, none of those things are your fault. So you're a hop, skip, and a jump away from a clean audit, and well done for that. And particularly, I really want to raise the issue of the 30-day payment to suppliers. I think that is critical for our economy. We hear lots of stories of small businesses having to close down because they're waiting for payment from government departments. So you are leading by example in that respect, and I thank you for that. My first question is, we know how competitive the global vehicle manufacturing industry is, and how countries compete for these production lines very fiercely. I just wanted to ask you what the initial effects that you've seen of the motor industry strike have been, and whether you've been active in that space at all. If you can give us the inside track there. Secondly, I still hold the view, you'll recall that I've raised this before that the department doesn't spend enough money on consumer regulation and enforcement. I like the fact that you said you were asking for 110 million more for that program, if I'm not mistaken. I think that's good, but probably still not enough. I just wanted to ask you specifically why the significant decline in the amount spent on the ECIC. I think it went from 120 million to 20 million or something like that. And then thirdly, you appointed 40 field workers across the whole country. Can you just tell us a little bit more about why it resulted? I mean, that's a significant expense. Why it's thought that that's necessary, and a little bit more about that program. Then, on the issue of local procurements, I completely agree. I think it was you that said the lack of a culture of buying local. And we have organizations like Party South Africa and others like it, but they're not nearly as active as one would like to see in driving that culture of local procurements. Just among the general populace. And I've used this example before, but when you go to, you know, your Toyota dealership down on foreshore, where I bought my own Toyota, and you ask them which of these many Toyotas is produced in South Africa, they're not able to tell you which models are produced. So there's a great need for just general awareness, general education about which products are in fact manufactured in South Africa. I see your book, for example, has got the proudly South African logo right on the front, and that's very nice. Your annual report has got it right on the front there. So that tells you that this is a product that is local content. But there's very, very few products out there where you see that where you see that kind of upfront logo. Thank you very much.
Just one short question here, DDG. The department's view of the entity's recapitalization, we referring then to NEF and ECIP. Thanks. It's over to yourselves now. I'm not sure just how you want to deal with it.
I think, thanks, Honourable Chair. I think we will follow the same process, which is the difficult question gets deferred to the DDGs. I think I'll just handle some and my colleagues will definitely come in. Firstly, thanks for the comment that was made and the support to the department. I think if I can maybe just try to go through it maybe systematically. I think Honourable Dames raised the issue about intellectual property and I'm going to ask Zodwa as the sort of champion of that to maybe make some comments. But I think the point is noted that this area of IP policy is obviously critical, and especially as a country with our emerging market challenges, but also being a having parts of the economy which is well developed, we should actually be able to, like we did under the generic medicines thing, where South Africa's involvement led to that breakthrough in WTO, where we were allowed to do parallel imports and to have generics. I think that we played a leading role in that discussion, and I think we should try to maintain that space in the intellectual property area of being, let's say, world leaders in this debate and so on. So I think the point is taken that we then need to develop and improve our capacity in that area. But I think, as I said, Zodwa, they have now released the policy framework. We are in negotiations with the other government departments, and then we'll undertake a broader consultation exercise. But I think the point is well taken, made by Honourable Dames, that this area we're going to be giving increasing focus to. I think with regard to the intellectual property, well, I think Honourable James was in that NCOB meeting where this matter was discussed. As I said, this debate can, let's say, protecting our indigenous knowledge, the form and manner in which we chose to do it using intellectual property. I think, as I said, that debate is ongoing. But as I can just repeat the perspective of the department, that our intervention was that we had a short-term pressure, and even the political sensitivities around protection of our indigenous knowledge, our loss of patents of the Khoisan and others, music and so on, we needed direct intervention for here and now, and that's why we thought that, imperfect as it is, let's say contaminating the beauty of intellectual property or patent act, we think we needed to make a short-term intervention. But as I said, that matter has been debated, but the point is taken. I think on Ms. Honourable Member Thring's vote, I think it's mainly comments that is made. I think we note that. I think I'll just comment on one of that, which is which also raised by Honourable McIntosh, which is the trade deficit we face. And I think our Minister of Finance has said that this is our biggest vulnerability. Because of such a large trade deficit, you can see any movement in the U.S. Monetary policy, any movement in the capital flows has a big impact on our currency, because we've got one of the most highly traded currencies. So our exposure is great. I think that the concern is that we are so, because the bulk of our exports is commodities, our trade deficit fluctuates with the commodity prices. So as we know, we've seen a 40-50% reduction in the cost of platinum or in the price of platinum in some of the minerals and so on. So that's the added vulnerability to our, obviously, in that first meeting, as the presentation yesterday by Anglo-American or the Chamber of Mining showed, even in our boom period, all of our commodity export earnings was not because of increased production. It was all just the rising commodity prices in the early 2000s. So we, now that those prices have fallen, our deficit is just increasing.
the other factor that has not helped the process until recently is that because our exchange rate was so strong when our commodity prices were rising, we're obviously importing everything because of the strength of our currency, and we're uncompetitive again in our export markets. And so I think we really are a very vulnerable economy because of our trade exposure and so on. So I think the only long-term solution is going to be for us to reduce our the importance of commodity exports and mineral prices as our major export basket. We have to have a much more diversified export basket, which means we must have much more agricultural products in there, we must have more manufacturing products, and then obviously we are endowed with minerals. But if we have a diverse, our 30%, let's say, from each sector, that will really save us from the vacillations in commodity prices. But I think the long-term solution is also we need...
I didn't just make comments, but there were three specific questions, and I think you've answered one.
Okay.
My other two questions were progress with regards to beneficiation and cooperation with regards to municipality. So they were just...
Thanks, yeah. Let me turn to the issue of beneficiation. As I indicated, I think this is the area of slowest progress. It's much spoken about, but actual beneficiation projects is slow. So that's why when I indicated in the report, we've made progress in clothing and textiles, autos, and so on. But the area we haven't really made significant impact on is beneficiation. I think that's going to be the area that part of it is also beneficiation requires lots of electricity. We don't have the electricity, so many of our beneficiation projects actually shut down. So we're actually in a worse position than that. But so I think this is absolutely an area which is the challenge. And then on municipalities, I think my colleagues will comment and so on, but I think we realize that for economic activity, the centrality of municipalities. So, for example, on the incubators, the supplier box, and the special economic zones, we are now saying there's that critical relationship between the municipality, the province, and national, as all three tiers of government must be working with municipalities, but also in terms of our procurement, as we can see, big procurement of buses. As we can see, just the Western Cape, Gauteng, or Joburg, and Tshwane tenders have resulted in us being able to energize our bus manufacturing sectors and so on. So municipalities are critical not only in terms of local development, but that. I think Honorable Sue van der Merwe, I think, has probably made this key point about this Team South Africa challenge we have. Because as you know, we have probably the worst in terms of the disjuncture between private and public sectors. And as we notice with every other country, there's no distinction between a Chinese business and a Chinese government official. They're just China. Similarly with the U.S. and so on. So obviously it's part of our history, but I think that is going to be, in terms of our new export strategy, we are trying to, let's say, beef up massively our export strategy. And one of that is that we are revitalizing now our export councils. Now our export councils are actually based on manufacturers. The business have formed their own export councils, so we have a council for clothing and textiles. We have Fruit Exporters Council, we have different exporters councils, but I think they have been neglected for a while. That is one way, and so you get at the forefront of our export drive must be the private sector. As I said, government can only play the role of opening doors and facilitators, like we're doing in China. There's 80 companies, private sector companies going there. All that government has done was to finance the very small enterprises, and we obviously have worked with the Chinese government to be sure that there are buyers coming to those exhibitions and so on. So I think that let's say, complementary role between the DERCO, DTI, but also the export drive must be led by the private sector, and we must play the facilitative role and so on. I think Jody or Tiso will maybe comment about the vacancies that we have. Then Honourable Member Wahili's point again, I think our chief economist will maybe address some of that issue around the MSEP program and maybe also comment TDG Strachan around the beneficiation and the big electricity issues. I think the point is taken that he made the example about the FAW investment in Port Elizabeth, where we do have many, many municipalities and provinces competing for the same level of investment. I think that on the one hand, I don't think it's probably a healthy development that many municipalities, many provinces are actively engaged in attracting investment and promoting exports and so on. I think what we are doing now as a TDI more and more, we are coordinating the entire SA package with regard to investments and exports. So, for example, we work with the provinces, we work with all the IZs to give a joint package, and we started doing that with the BRICS, where you can see we presented a list of our top 10 investment projects, and that was drawn from some of the IDZs, it was drawn from right across the country. So we try to reinforce what provinces and municipalities are doing. But I think that's a critical point made. I think the Honourable McIntosh point is taken that at least some part of our, is right, that part of our deficit is due to increase in import of capital goods, which as I said, or intermediate goods is not a problem because you add value to it or you use the machinery which expands your productive capacity in the long run and so on. But unfortunately, many of our exports, unfortunately, it's oil, 25% I think of our import basket is oil and petroleum products, which means we are obviously vulnerable to the oil price, which has led to it. And then also luxury goods is still the peak. As you know, we might make the C-class, but the E-class is all imported. And there's still many, many luxury imports. But our biggest export imports are is oil, pharmaceutical products, and then motor vehicles imports, especially the... So I think there is that difficulty still in our trade deficit. I think that the issue is raised about the food budget, the 7 billion food budget, and I think probably, I don't know whether Parliament can play a bit more active role, but as a TDI we have been championing this idea of having set-asides. With our government, out of a government budget is set aside for small business and cooperatives. There are other people in government who feel that that is not constitutional, that it's you can't do that and so on. I think that that debate is coming up more and more, but it must be resolved. That and very soon that we do set aside, and I think maybe again the chief economist can comment. We tried to take that to the cabinet Lehotla recently, where we say that we must have set-asides of especially items like food, furniture, those kind of items can easily be set aside for cooperatives and for small businesses. I think the final area I want to comment on, and it's raised by Honourable Chair and then Honourable Khadebe and others, is this issue of the visas. I think that has come up prominently in a visit with Nigeria, where Dangote raised it very forcefully that they have become big investors in this economy. He himself has invested in 2 cement plants in the country, and they have difficulty getting visas and multiple entry visas and so on. It was also raised very forcefully at the BRICS Business Council. So I think that is one area of TISA division, but I will take this point. We will then engage with Home Affairs and then in time report to Portfolio Committee, but I think it's the biggest area, especially for business people, because as I said, they bring investment and they bring trade to the country. I think I'm going to then just ask maybe Zodwa and then other colleagues to come.
Thank you, Director General and Chairperson. Just a few comments on the beneficiation issues. I think, if I may say so, Honourable Thring, we also have to get into the debate about what we mean by beneficiation. So everything we do is about beneficiation in a way, and I think we should avoid the notion that, the focus is only to beneficiation stage one, where we take iron ore and make it into steel. Getting higher up the value chain to beneficiation stage 14, where we've got a product which is very comprehensive near the technological frontier is what we should be about. Having said that, as we've reported before, we assembled, we think, probably the best team in South Africa, inclusive of the Department of Science and Technology, the IDC, and ourselves, and that team is led by Dr. Paul Jordan, and it has investigated over the last 9 months opportunities in beneficiation in 5 of the critical value chains, and hopefully by the launch of APEP 2014, 15, there will be significant progress with respect to beneficiation opportunities in those critical value chains. Then with respect to electricity, I think we need to commend Madam Chair of the committee and the committee itself that during the year in question you played a very important role in highlighting the issue not just of year-on-year electricity increases by Eskom, but perhaps especially the very critical question of the sometimes triple-digit hikes of municipalities and the differences in tariffs applied to industrial users, not only between municipalities, but even within municipalities, depending upon whether they're supplied by Eskom or the municipality, and the differing tariffs. And again, we're very mindful of this very significant problem and threat to the manufacturing sector. We have, as we reported before, have a team of people led by Dr. Rasmuji. They meet on a weekly basis with Eskom and with the National Treasury to understand very precisely what are the Eskom demand and supply measures, and Eskom has got the biggest demand side measures in the world, by the way, and there are specific contractual arrangements with the energy intensive users, and in addition to that, we are intervening literally on a weekly basis where there are problems with municipalities. So for example, in the Bacha Bang municipality, there was a threat even of some closure of some companies in the auto component sector, and the biggest constraint that they had was the extent to which the electricity prices had escalated sharply in that municipality as a result of municipal premiums being added to the Eskom rate. We intervened, we fashioned a solution between the auto component manufacturers and the municipality, I think, in creating a win-win situation. But the underlying problem, I think, remains, and that's the fact that the revenue structure of all our municipalities, electricity is, revenue is central to their revenue base, and so a long-term solution with the National Treasury has to be crafted. In respect to Bradley South Africa, I can't remember who asked the question, forgive me, honourable members, but this is very much part and parcel, it's very much on our radar screen. In fact, Jody Scholes, the COO, is leading a delegation next week to meet with Bradley South Africa. There's the issue of the functions of Proudly South Africa and Brand South Africa and how do they interlock. There's the question of is there the right institutional framework in place for Proudly South Africa. It's a NEDLAC institution and it reports to NEDLAC and the board and the DTI. So we're looking at the institutional architecture, we're looking at the funding, where we'd like to see a much stronger focus on programs rather than administration and events, which is meant as no insult to the work that's already happened, but we really want to ramp up the work on the MTEP. There is an increase in the budget for Proudly South Africa, and we think that on the back of more funds, stronger oversight, stronger emphasis on programs, stronger engagement with companies, especially in the manufacturing sector, that we can really have a significant improvement with respect to probably South Africa. Those are the three, I think, fall under industrial development, Madam Chair.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm Stephen Hannibal, the chief economist. If I can perhaps briefly respond to Honourable Member Wanile's question around the sectors, the companies in distress and how the MSEP has contributed to that. The MSEP is only just over a year old now, and around about 248 projects have actually been approved. So those are 248 companies that are being assisted. Around about 2 billion rand of the 6.2 billion rand budget have been committed, and in total from inception of the program we estimate that around about 40,000 jobs are being supported. And at the start of the program what we saw was quite a heavy concentration on capital investment and very little emphasis on energy efficiency and local procurement. But more recently we are seeing quite a significant shift now in terms of the windows of MSEP that companies are applying for. Many more companies are applying for capital equipment that is going to be locally procured, and that obviously is an additional benefit to the capital equipment sector. And there are also a number of requests coming through now for quite novel and innovative energy efficiency technologies, again, mainly locally procured. And of course, there is an element to the MSEP which supports black economic empowerment as well as job creation. Those are beginning to take off as well. But of the 6.2 billion rand budget over 3 years, already 2 billion rand has been committed, and the applications are coming in increasingly quickly. In terms of the sector side, DTI continues to engage with our colleagues in National Treasury around setting aside around about 10 products and services, things like food, juices and beverages, furniture, marketing services. We hope that later on this year we will be able to reach some finality with our colleagues in National Treasury. We are also in the impact assessment unit of DTI undertaking a study which looks at what the impact of set-asides would have been had we been able to reach agreement 2 or 3 years back. So what is the economic opportunity that in a sense we've potentially missed over this period. And then lastly, just an additional example of an energy efficiency issue is the Molteno rusks plant in Eastern Cape, which produces an old South African staple, Omar rusks. The plant also faced issues around electricity and DTI with the province, and the municipality was able to come up with a solution to ensure that the plant actually didn't close down and move to Johannesburg, which was one of the risks at the time. Thanks, Chair.
One of McIntosh's favourite biscuits in the yes, CIO, Ms. Scott.
Thank you, Jay. Just to respond to Honourable Van der Merwe, as at the report, the annual report is as at the 18th of March, the 8th of March, and there has been an extensive program internally in the DTI to train up a pool of individuals to be pledged in our offices abroad. We can get the latest stats available, and I think there has been some delays just in terms of finalizing security clearances for a number of individuals. But that process is well underway, and we proceeded to place people abroad. I think just in terms of the Honourable Hugh Lewis question about the recapitalization of the NEF and the ECFC, both of those have been included in the department's interim submission to the National Treasury, and there have been engagements at DG level and also at senior official level, just in terms of the process. Treasury have asked a number of questions, and so we are involved in that process with them. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. DD, Mr. Khan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just with regard to the question from Honourable Member Lewis with regard to ECIC and the budget dropping to 20 million rand in the last financial year. I'm sure all of the members are familiar with the Cuba package, the Cuba agreement, where the President agreed with the Cuban government a package deal with regard to assistance. If you look at the amount that dropped on the ECIC budget, there was a savings on the budget, and there was a transfer of function during the last year's adjustment process, in which there was 73 million rand moved from ECIC budget through to DERCO for the implementation of the Cuba agreement. So therefore, that's the reason for the decrease in the ECIC's budget.
DEG?
Well, I can choose not to say anything. So thank you very much. I think DG has already indicated that the points that have been made are taken. I think in terms of the draft IP policy that is out, we will be getting a lot of contributions, and I think you know, members are also welcome to help us in that area. We are scheduling a number of consultations with the key stakeholders. We've had a round of consultations with government, but we are also going to have another round. I think there are the main issues, honourable members alluded to, is the issue of coordination on IT, because there are elements of it that sit in a number of departments. And I think it talks again to what honourable member was saying about, you know, Team South Africa. All in that space is actually very important, because if we do not have an IT policy in the country that we can all speak to, we then go out speak differently on issues where government has taken a position. And I think with this IT policy, what we're trying to do is to say, what is the policy of this country in relation to IT, so that we can all speak in the same direction. I think also in terms of the issues around the protection of traditional knowledge, I think we have said that we are not apologetic about having processed that legislation, because we've indicated that the IT system is the one that is being used to exploit the traditional knowledge. And it is through that system that you need to close the gap. So we are doing that, and we are not precluding any other kind of protection that can be put forward to close gaps in other areas. So it's like, you know, for instance, if you say that, you know, you can just put burglar doors to your house, but then if people are using the roof to come in, you must then do something, put the alarm system so that you can detect whoever comes through the roof and not through the door. So that's what we're saying, and we continue to say that we will not apologize necessarily as a department for having put that process, because it was the policy that was adopted by this country, by this government in 2005. Hence, we moved on to amend the Patents Act to incorporate those issues, and it was a natural consequence that we move on to the other areas of IP, your design, your trademarks, and so forth and so forth. So, Chair, on that one, I think we've argued our point significantly, and it has been through Parliament, and I think we'll conclude on that one. The last point that I just wanted to talk to Chair is the point made by the Honourable Member, I think the question relating to the field workers. Chair, you recall that over the years when we came to report to Parliament kept on asking us about the rural uptake. Every time we look at our uptake of services, whether incentives, grants, anything, you find that the provinces that are largely rural, they always have a less take-up. And so we introduce mechanisms to increase that take-up without necessarily putting structures of offices, but to have field workers that can be on different areas in the communities to facilitate the take-up. And that is why those field workers were rolled out in the various provinces, and they will move from area to area so that we are able to cover at least a number of rural places that ordinarily would not be in a position to go to. We will assess the program, because we've rolled out the first phase. We'll assess the program. If it is effective, we'll then continue with it. If there are gaps, we'll then see how to close the gaps and how we improve it. But we do think that it's going to go a long way to assist in trying to get the rural outreach for the department.
Thanks. Just in conclusion, on the chair, there's just two issues to add to the one is to honourable thing. Just with regard to the focus areas of beneficiation, we did at the last cabinet of Hotla, as we said, we're trying to get to grips with this very amorphous concept and trying to give it focus. So now they've adopted our proposal, which is the following areas is going to be our focus on, and the programs will be developed. We've said platinum, titanium, the iron and steel, and then diamonds and jewelry areas. Those are going to be the four areas, so it links into what you were saying about diamonds. So now they're going to develop concrete programs around these four areas of beneficiation. then finally, Honourable Member Darby Lewis, about the issue of the labour strikes issue. I think that, of course, I mean, our minister engaged with the bargaining council or the bargaining session, the first bargaining sessions they had, to try to emphasize to the players that really we've managed to make significant progress in building a world-class auto industry, and we need to ensure that there's absolute stability in the labor relations environment and so on. And of course, also it was during the when the one of the BMW's vice presidents or something was in the country during the strike as well, and the minister met with him. So obviously we had to do a lot of explaining to try to contextualize that fortunately in the auto industry we do have a very good collective bargaining system still operating. It's unlike other areas where you have completely wildcat strikes, very weak unions and so on. At least we had a long relationship between NAMSA and NUMSA. But as I said, it is very sensitive because these players are global exporters. They cannot afford interruptions in their exports because obviously they're their competitors. People, instead of buying the BMW from his London plant, they then buy him and somebody else's car. So, but I think we've been trying to emphasize the importance of stability in the labor relations environment as part of that.
Very much, DG. Just the last few comments. First of all, thank you very much for several of the innovations and improvements in the presentation from the department on the financials and comprehensive approach, the very small issues and yet very important of the abbreviations, etc., which we've always been asking for. And I think a very important approach, which is now really coming into its own. Reasons for material expenditure variance, and we need the reasons for all expenditure, you know, matrix, if you like. The variance, yes, thank you very, very much. We've been asking for this. We've really made a very solid start here. The other thing is the actual focusing. I know many pages here, etc., but nevertheless, yes, this is a massive portfolio, and therefore, we appreciate you have been able to address all of the critical issues, and it does take one back 5 years or 4 years ago when the clothing, textiles, and the footwear sector was really in crisis. And, you know, to remind members now, this has been a tremendous turnaround. I mean, there was such a hemorrhage of jobs in that sector, and the measures taken have worked. The other one, which one sees coming into fruition again to promote that sector, is of course ensuring that retail outlets and companies establish this relationship, and the negotiations or the you know, promotion and the work you've done in that area with the private sector itself. I think that is to be commended. Of course, the committee itself is to be commended. Indeed, Honourable Waiili did have a little music there to underline what the acting DDG was saying about the committee highlighting the issues around energy and its impact on the manufacturing sector. And, I mean, we really have to also appreciate the input there from an intervention by the Honourable Sue van der Merwe, who, when we saw all this disagreement there between everyone and suggested a colloquium. I think the very word itself gives everyone quiet. But you know, that certainly brought all these argumentative stakeholders who were defending their positions to the table to say, let's try and develop a solution. How do we go forward positively from here? In the interim, we've also had all the, port, was it port net or something, their prices have come down, admin prices have been tackled in this regard, and even in terms of trade on, in the departmental area, you know, these issues have been raised by the ANC and the DA by these external officers right from the beginning. I remember in 2010, the Honourable Hadebe raised the issue of funding in this area, and was there any way we could increase that, or just to assist here to ensure we were right on top of it. and you've increased the trade missions. Now it indicates about other staff, you know, being trained and ready to, as it were, be deployed in that area. And it's hardly a final issue because there are so many incentives here to look at. But there has been an improvement in tightening up the incentives. Although here and there, the you know, I know it's very difficult to refine how many jobs are created by each incentive because quite clearly, I mean, the department doesn't have everyone's ID, etc. But then you have to look at a central approach to the matter. So many jobs created here, etc. And we do recognize and appreciate that. And I think the one thing we heard, and I was in another forum at the time, so we knew Honourable Fakebi, when we heard about the very solid relationship DTI have developed with agriculture and agriculture and forestry, is it, in respect of our oceans and the manufacturing there, and the shipbuilding, and all of that has been taken cognizance of, and the fishing industry. So there are many things that you know, there have been improvements both with the committee and yourselves, but you know, there are still many challenges that remain, and I think you are aware of that, and we need certainly, as we go through this process, to see how best we can craft sharper measures, if you like, to address these particular issues. But we welcome diversification of trade, which had enabled us to overcome many of the challenges that the European crisis has created for us and the impact there, as well as, you know, Bernanke and his gymnastics with the American, value of the currency up and down like a yo-yo. Now, of course, we are finally beginning to benefit a little, but there's no guarantee that tapering off will remain where it is. You see, moments notice it could change again. So yes, we are aware of that, and it's good to know that beneficiation is still there, but I think it is a matter of concern that we haven't made the progress there that we had hoped to make, for whatever the reason. But we started, and that is a very good sign. So all in all, notwithstanding the highly focused analysis the committee will do and the scrutiny, we have the benefit of a very competent researcher here, Ms. Zakwanda Madalani, who's prepared a top-quality analysis where she draws our attention to many of the issues you heard raised here, although they probably raised them before even looking at this particular report. But I do think, members, this will assist you as well. See what the researcher has prepared for us, as well as the first quarter. So please look at it and study it, all of us. And just to refresh your memories, we are going to return to the BRRR on, just give me the date, Mr. Hill. The 2nd and 3rd of October. So just so members are aware, the 2nd and the 3rd of October. We need you here. South Africa expects every committee member to do its duty. Right. Now, thank you very much, DG, on that note. And then we just need to return briefly with the DDG, Ms. Ntuli, and Advocate Stridham to a couple of those issues that we were fine-tuning or crafting amendments on, proposals. Thank you. Page 5 of the hot copy that's here. DG, G, are we going to start now? Page 3.
Who was that, Chair? Johan will take us through the changes.
Advocate Spider.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll do my utmost to be as brief as possible. There's a new document now, new reference number. Everything, Madam Chair, is now back. The only portions in green here reflect what we've been doing in the break just now. All the rest is back. Allow me straight away to go to the first one, which is on page 3 of the A-list. On page 6 of our bill, in line 35, to omit the words such membership, to substitute his or her employment, because it relates to a commissioner or any employee. So membership is inappropriate, it should be employment. After the termination or expiry of his or her employment, take up employment and rest. And then the very next line is item 25, which is in line 36. We remain on page 6 of the bill, and here is the provision now for a grant to be included within the ambit of this provision. So in line 36 it would read, take up employment or in any way receive any benefit from any person who received a grant or intends to apply, or has applied. Madam Chair, unless I'm interrupted, I will simply move on.
Everyone, so far we're all on track. We are moving with the advocate.
Page 5 of the A-list, Madam Chair. Item 3, just below the middle of the page. On page 10, from lines 30 to 42, we omit the existing subsection 3 and we substitute the following. In appointing an organ of state to conduct the national lottery, the requirements contemplated in section 13.2a and B, small Roman 4, those are in the Principal Act, of course, do not apply. I will not discuss again, we had a discussion this morning, and it seems as everything in that subsection 2 or 3 should be applicable, save for these two provisions. So the requirements contemplated in section 13.2a and B4 of the Principal Act do not apply. I see there the hand, Madam Chair.
Okay, Honourable Gil Lewis.
Yeah, I don't understand why they don't apply. Sorry if I'm being off, but I don't.
An explanation.
And it said we take the class with a small Roman 4. For those who have possession of the Principal Act, it says in sub 2, that's now in the Principal Act, section 13, sub 2, it starts with the preceding words. Before license is granted under this section, and this might now be a license, the normal kind of license, for a licensee to do the necessary, or now this new kind of license that we're having in 13, capital A, where the minister deems so appropriate. It applies now to both those scenarios. And then a small Roman 4. No political party in the Republic or political office bearer has any direct financial interest in the applicant or the shareholder of the applicant. So maybe I need not even say that it is indeed conceivable that such financial interest might be in existence and would therefore preclude the appointment from being made. That is why we're suggesting that this requirement should not apply when it comes to the appointment of the organ of state to conduct the lottery.
Right, has everyone understood the application? Not we, understood. Right, we've all understood. Do you still have a query, Honourable Hill-Lewis?
But surely, Chair, that's inconceivable. I mean, how can a political party have a financial interest in the in operation of the lotto?
Talking of an organ of state here.
I don't see how it is conceivable.
And Chair, the suggest to me is that there is no, there can never be such a possibility from arising. We might reconsider. Maybe the DDG can guide us.
I think let the committee guide you. Lord Hill, let's have a think about what we've heard. I've heard your concern. Let me see whether or not I agree with it. That's what I'm saying. All right?
I think the intention of the committee was that a political party should not have an interest in a company that's running the lotto. Is that an agreement with everybody? So then, get the cobwebs out and see how this reads. Does that what your amendment says?
The amendment says that when this consideration is taking place, then all the requirements that we have in on subsection 2 as well as subsection 3 will be applicable and should be taken into consideration. As we read them, we will see why. But now, we simply exclude. Or, not we exclude, the proposal is that small Roman law should be excluded from that consideration, and also what we have in paragraph A of subsection 2. But let's not go there for the time being. May I suggest that we remain with small Roman 4. If it's indeed the stance of this Honourable Committee that no political party should have any financial interest in the organ of state that will be conducting this lottery, then the saving or the exclusion does not appear to be omitted.
So, let me take Honourable Frank.
I think my understanding is that if you have your commissioner appointing and granting a license to an organ of state, what are the conditions? Now, when we're looking at the conditions, we are referring to, in the Principal Act, we're looking at Section 13, Chapter 2, Section 13 of the Principal Act. So, we are saying that where an organ of state is granted a license and the commissioner and so on is involved, we cannot have in Chapter 2, Section 13, items Section 2A and B4 as a part of those conditions. We have to exclude those conditions in order for it to read properly. So that's my understanding. And it makes sense for us to do that so that the commissioner is in no way going to be seen to be biased with regards to political party interference and so on.
Thank you, Honourable Fring. Added a note of sanity here. Honourable Vandenova.
Well, I'm afraid I'm going to be insane then because I disagree with Mr. Fring. I think what the new bill, the new A, page 5, item 3 should read. On page 10, pronounce 30 to 42, omit section 3 and to substitute the following.
So the new bill page?
Page 5.
3, the appointing of organ of state to conduct a national lottery, requirements contemplated in section 13A to 2A, rather, do not apply. That's what it should say. All the other things apply. It's only that one that does not apply.
Correct. That's what I'm saying. I agree.
Of course, you said include it.
No.
No, that's why I said a note of sanity. No, there we are. We this thing has got us all grappling around. So you're not confused, are you, advocate?
Maybe I should not give you an honest answer to that question, editor. Please allow me to say the following. If we read 13:2a with the preceding words, I'm sorry for that, but we must. Before a license is granted under this section 30, then B, the minister shall, no discretion, the minister shall be satisfied that, and then we go to small Roman 4, no political party in the Republic has an interest in that organ of state. So purely as a matter of, this is the legal premise. I'm not saying anything on the political or policy kind of considerations. That in making this or in exercising this discretion, this ministerial discretion, the minister would not be bound by small Roman 4. That's what it says. The rest is for debate.
The membership wants the minister to abide by B4. Now, is this what's there? Is this what we say? I hope I'm understanding the membership correct. Honourable Kadeli.
That the minister, when allocating a license to a state organ, he must ensure, or she or he must ensure that no political party has got an interest in the state organ. That this is love.
number 3, and that we instead exclude the words and bracket B bracket small Roman 4. That's what we must exclude, and then we will accept it.
Yeah, that on note green, page 5, we're saying in appointing an organ of state to conduct the national lottery, the requirements contemplated in section 3.2a do not apply. Full stop. And so you take off and the spore. DDG?
We are happy.
Don't tell me you're not happy.
Then I've got a question on 2A. Thanks, Chair. So let me just go back to my bill, my act. All very confusing. Okay. It said that the minister shall, by notice in the Gazette, in 2 newspapers, whatever, request proposals and any other documents which be made in public, and the board shall require payment for such documents. Now, we're exempting him from doing that in this case. I'm just not 100% clear why, because he's still going to, in order to get the request for proposals, then he's going to consider the proposals and see that none of them meet these requirements, and then license an organ state. So he still has to do that.
I wonder, Honourable Member, remember when you speak, if you could just get it on the mic.
Chair, as far as I read it, we are dealing in the amendment bill under 13, under a heading, appointment of organ of state to conduct the national lottery. This does not affect the first process that he's going to undergo, which is the process where he puts it out for public application.
Right. So can I just, if I understand Honourable Fanavarova correctly, DDG, the process works as follows. A call for applications is issued publicly. Applications are received. None are suitable based on the grounds that we've put into this bill. Then a state organ is issued in terms of 13A without a new gazette having a new gazetting. Do I understand that process correctly?
We understand you. That seems to be the first advertisement, and now no one was found. The understanding is there should be no need for another advertisement.
I think the explanation is correct on the other hand, but then I think the question is, remember that there are specific grounds for the minister to appoint a state organ. It may be that even during the operation of the current license that may be in place at the time, on assessment, clearly you can see that there's no point in getting a private person to run it. And on the grounds in the Act, then the minister can decide to go and appoint an organ of state. So I think if we put in sequence purely that way, it's like it excludes that the minister must always go out on a beach first and check. He can assess it on the basis of all of the licenses that have been issued before and say, over this period, we are not achieving the objectives. So I'm not sure, but maybe also your hand from whether in the drafting, that's what it suggests, but I'm just putting it from a perspective why we had a separate grounds. Because if you look at the previous setting still allowed that a state organ could actually be, and specifically indicated that the state organ must not be favored purely because it's a state organ. So it did allow for them to be. But in this case, it's where the minister, on those grounds, decides that we are appointing a state organ, we are not taking the license out.
Yeah, so I just wanted to land the point. I just wanted to be clear on the process, so thanks for that.
Right, okay, now we have that very clear. I think we're able to move to 4 on page 5. No.
Madam Chair, this is the issue that was raised by the Honourable Ian Lewis. Page 5 of the A-list, item 4. On page 10, in line 46, after minister, page 10, line 46, after minister, we insert that very same proviso that we find in the other place. There is maybe now just one consequential amendment, if I am still in the picture, on what is the policy grounds. I'm not convinced that I am. I apologize for that. But if then that small Roman 4 is coming back, then we would need a small consequential here, 1, 2, and 3. Maybe my colleagues will fill me in. I think my head is maybe going other places prematurely. I move on to item 5.
Mr. Advocate Hercule.
Thank you, Chair. Just on that note, the consequential amendment would be item 4, the third line, the reference to section 13.2b, Roman 1, 2, and 3. The bracket Roman 1, 2, and 3 should be deleted, so the provisions of section 13.2b will then apply.
Fortunate that I've got a colleague who's not in the dock. I really appreciate that, Madam Chair. That's why we're more than one.
Yeah, but isn't his name Hercules?
Yeah.
Do go ahead.
I would refrain from making any comments as far as that is concerned, Madam Chair. Item 5, still page 5 of our list. On page 10, after line 46, we insert, the minister shall publish in the Gazette the appointment of an organ estate to conduct the national lottery in terms of section.
Madam Chair,
checking now. Right, this is the 20th of September now. Right, okay. And what is it? Just a minute. 12:45. Right, so we're sitting with this fresh copy here, which we are in broad agreement with, which is now going to go to CREDA. Well, it's going to be checked. You're going to develop an A and B list. Is that right, Mr. Herman? With T, whom I think should have a break before they start on this, but yes, we want this to get to CREDA today, and for CREDA to be alerted so that they are aware, Mr. Herman. Is that right? They have been alerted. Right. So, really, it's thanks to the DDG. It's been a long process up to now. It will still continue in a week's time. Thanks to yourself, Advocate Sidon, and also Mr. Sabella, Advocate Hercules, and of course all the other members from DTI who are here with us. And you can see, as you embark on this career, this is not a job that's for anyone, the faint-hearted, you know. It's a job for those who know how to work. So, right, so now, please, we are back here on the 2nd. Is that earlier? At what time and what venue? We are the Old Assembly, no, the E249. Is the 2nd a holiday? Or what about being the milk? All right, it's the 2nd and the 3rd. Yeah, to round off the new program. The 2nd, which is a Wednesday, 9:30 and E249 to be confirmed. And on Thursday, the 3rd, 9 o'clock. And you will see there that we'll be doing the lotteries, the Creda copy, the BRRR, the BRRR, and continuing with the BRRR on the 3rd. Right. We are trying to get this ATC. Is it the following week, Honourable Kadevi? When are we trying to get this ATC? When are we trying to get this on the ATC? That's all been well, because if Peter has to make changes. Right. Okay. So let's try and work on that basis, and please can we start on time then on Wednesday the 2nd. Thank you very much for that. And not only is this meeting adjourned, but that... my hand's flying up. Honourable McIntosh.
Madam Chair, I wanted to ask in a matter of, the 2nd and the 3rd of October, fine, but I don't know, there's a parliamentary program. I'm not sure that there's a provision for committees to meet that week. I don't know where I'm just thinking in terms of the rules, that's all.
Fortunately, we study the rules, so in terms of the rules we applied for dispensation. Honourable Hilder?
Chair, the 2nd, I have a very full afternoon. Obviously this is the first time I've heard that we're sitting on the 2nd, so I've got a full afternoon on the afternoon of the 2nd. From 2 PM onwards, I can be here in the morning. The third is a lot more open. I see we're sitting until 5 on the 2nd, but only until 11 on the 3rd. And I wonder whether it may suit more people to swap those 2 days around. I just put that up.
Well, look, I don't want to spend time debating time, because I think all of us have exigencies. But obviously we will review this. So we're all okay on Thursday, I take it. And we can meet Thursday until 3 or whatever. Is that right? Looking at everyone. Honourable McIntosh, good. Honourable Thring. On Wednesday, when we come back then to this, we meet at 9 o'clock and finish then at 1 o'clock. At we'll allow the secretary to make the shift and email us accordingly. Now, there was one other thing that we need to remind you of. The only person who's put anything in writing to us is the Honourable Hill Lewis when he raised some amendment. You recall that? Yes. Now, the thing is, anyone who wants to make amendments, it is not a requirement by the rules, but it does help matters to proceed more speedily if it is in writing. So please send it to the secretary of the committee. I will get it in due course, and we will, of course, make it available to other members. When is the deadline for those amendments in writing, or they can come verbally later? On Monday the 1st. Let's try and close it off then, and then you'll have to add them verbally after that. Is the AMC happy with that from the AMC point? Honourable Amanda Merver?
Chair, that's fine, but I just wanted to know if we could, for the record, know when this debate will be.
That matter, the debate is debatable, the timing. You know, it's a simple thing. It really does depend on Parliament. You see, we don't set the plenary, but let me allow the whip, Honourable Kadeli.
The 20%, I think that's what happens in the first 2 weeks we have in the committee with men. So it means that after the 15th is that we are going to be able to have the plenaries. And then what is critical out of that is the availability of the minister. As we know that he's doing good work all over the world. I think that if we can get an indication from the PLO when the availability of the minister, so that the person can lock it up with the programming committee immediately.
There is, we should never forget that Parliament does from time to time slot in another plenary, as it were. And there is a view running around that this could happen on the 8th, just a view, on the 8th of October, that there's a possible plenary. But it would be, you know, for me, irresponsible to start making any arrangements for the 8th. I'm sure you understand that. Next week we'll all, I'll certainly be in a better position to know if there is a plenary, and you will be informed accordingly. Is that fair enough? We want you to be kept informed, all right? And the Minister, we would like to be there. Whether I'm there or not, it's not going to affect the debate. All right. Thank you. Let's make that very clear. Honourable members, thank you very much. Thank you to DTI, State Law Advisor, and the Parliamentary Legal Advisor. Thank you. And to Mr. Ernst and staff, to Kwanda Madalani, who've done a lot of work